That has been hurt.
My pride!
By the honesty in my declaration!
Pride and Prejudice, this weekend on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Begins on Saturday at 3:15.
On 92 to 95 FM and on BBC Sounds, this is BBC Radio 4. Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Tuesday the 9th of December. This is Today with Justin Webb and Anna Foster.
The headlines this morning, the head of a national review into NHS maternity care in England says she's been shocked at the scale of unacceptable treatment for women and families across the country. Baroness Valerie Amos will be with us at 7:30. A social media ban for under-16s is coming into force in Australia. We ask, will it work?
From my perspective, it's kind of insulting to think that they don't trust me with the internet.
Social media isn't necessary. It's like a privilege we have.
To take away something, it kind of makes you want it even more.
We'll be discussing what the ban will mean, not just for Australia, but around the world as well, with former TikTok boss at 10 past eight.
Also in today's programme, at 13, Alyssa Tapley thought she was going to die from leukaemia. She became the first person in the world to receive a revolutionary gene therapy treatment, and 3 years later, she is cancer-free. She'll join us at 20 past seven. People trying to access their own care records are being let down, says the Information Commissioner, who wants faster and better data handed over. We'll discuss that at 8:30. And
they're very small, they're really cute. And I said, how would that do in this country? And everyone seems to think good, but you're not allowed to build them. And I've authorized the secretary to immediately approve the production of those cars.
President Trump's excitement there over Japanese K cars. So could those tiny vehicles provide a big solution for America's roads? We'll find out. Before all of that, though, the BBC News is read for us this morning by Jane Steele.
The head of a national review into NHS maternity care in England says she's been shocked by what she called the constant experiences of trauma that women and families have gone through across the country. In a report giving her initial findings, Baroness Amos says nothing prepared her for the scale of unacceptable treatment. She says families continue to be let down by a lack of basic care and empathy, despite hundreds of recommendations made after inquiries into maternity services in the past decade. Here's our social affairs correspondent, Michael Buchanan.
Baroness Amos was asked by the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, to chair a review looking at why so many families receive poor maternity care in England. She said consistent themes have already emerged, women being ignored and feeling blame for the deaths of their babies, while NHS organisations are viewed as marking their own homework when things go wrong. Class and colour matter too, with poor and black women often receiving worse care. Maternity staff also reported receiving death threats while working in poorly performing units. Previous inquiries, said Baroness Amos, had led to almost 750 recommendations for improving maternity care, yet still the harm continues. Wes Streeting has promised to implement the review's own recommendations when they're published in the spring.
A new law comes into force later today in Australia, banning young teens from some of their favourite social media platforms, including Snapchat, TikTok and Instagram. It's being touted as world-first legislation and will mean that if companies fail to take reasonable steps to prevent under-16s from opening accounts, they could be fined up to £25 million. Katie Watson reports from Sydney.
The new rules mean no more Snapchat or TikTok videos or liking of photos. Some of the most popular social media platforms will be off-limits for under-16s. People here are calling it a ban. The government prefers to use the word delay, giving youngsters more time to grow up before being let loose on social media. Whatever the term, the majority of teens are not happy about it. Plenty of parents, on the other hand, see this as a show of support by the government, standing up to the big US tech companies who've been criticised for not doing enough in recent years to prevent online harm.
A police review into the Army's top spy in the IRA, known as Steak Knife, is to publish its final report. The findings are likely to include new information on how he was recruited. Detectives from the investigation called Operation Canova have also been examining the extent to which the security forces colluded with the loyalist paramilitary group in the 1970s. A report out today is expected to say that rapidly designed COVID support programs, such as the furlough scheme, created a golden opportunity for fraudsters. The review from the COVID Fraud Commissioner, Tom Hayhoe, is expected to say that rushed implementation and a lack of controls contributed to losses to the taxpayer of almost £11 billion. A revolutionary gene therapy has successfully treated patients with aggressive and previously incurable blood cancers. It involves editing the DNA of donated white blood cells to make them attack cancer cells, but not the patient's body. The procedure has been developed by scientists at Great Ormond Street Hospital and University College, led by Professor Waseem Kazim.
A few years ago, this would have been science fiction, but now we can actually collect white blood cells from healthy donors and use them for their powerful immune effects by reprogramming them and asking them to go and hunt down leukemia when they're given back to patients.
Cambodia and Thailand say they've launched fresh strikes against each other as their long-running border dispute again flares into deadly conflict. Cambodia says two more civilians have been killed in overnight shelling by Thai forces, bringing the total deaths on its side to seven. Thailand has reported that two more of its soldiers have been killed. Tens of thousands of people have been forced to flee their homes. Both sides have blamed each other for the clashes, which have derailed a fragile ceasefire brokered by President Trump in July. A BBC investigation has found that an Anglican bishop accused of bullying is facing fresh complaints of alleged misconduct. Bishop Anne Dyer, Scotland's first female bishop, was temporarily suspended while the Scottish Episcopal Church investigated earlier allegations, which she denies. She says the new complaints are totally without merit. Steve Swan reports.
Anne Dyer made history when she became the Bishop of Aberdeen and Orkney in 2018, but her time at the helm has been controversial. In 2021, a report commissioned by the church concluded she should resign over concerns about her leadership style. She didn't, and said the report was flawed. Last year, a senior lawyer ruled against a church tribunal into claims she'd bullied three women, despite finding a realistic prospect of conviction. Falun 4 Investigates has learned Bishop Dyer returned to work last November without a risk assessment, and that since then at least six fresh complaints of misconduct have been made against her. Bishop Dyer says the complaints are frivolous and totally without merit. The Scottish Episcopal Church says it acknowledges deep wounds, but has called for reconciliation.
A number of severe weather warnings have come into force in parts of Wales, Scotland and southwest England as Storm Bram sweeps across the UK. The Met Office says the storm could lead to damage to homes and buildings, flooding, power cuts and significant travel disruption. In northwest Scotland, gusts of up to 90 miles per hour are forecast, while as much as 3 inches of rain is expected to fall widely across affected areas. The winner of this year's prestigious Turner Art Prize will be announced tonight at a ceremony in Bradford, the UK's City of Culture. Four artists have been nominated to win the £25,000 prize, following in the footsteps of Damien Hirst, Rachel Whiteread and Steve McQueen.
Thank you for that. 7 minutes past six is the time. It sounded from that news bulletin, didn't it, as if the weather was rather serious this morning. So let's turn without further ado to Helen Willits at the BBC Weather Centre. Morning, Helen.
Morning, Justin. Absolutely. Storm Bram sweeping across the UK will have far-reaching impacts for many. There are warnings out quite widely. So let's start across Scotland, where the rain is pouring down for many. It may well get off to a dry start for the far north, but that rain is heading northwards. So yellow warnings for rain out widely. And then the winds really escalate this afternoon. So from mid-afternoon onwards, that amber warning for gusts potentially up to 90 miles an hour in the northwest of Scotland. So you can imagine elsewhere it will be widely windy. Those could cause quite significant damage, uprooting trees, ripping off roofs. Please stay tuned to the forecasts. Northern Ireland, we'll see the heaviest rain starting to clear in the next few hours, but there'll be plenty of bursts of intense rain, thunder and lightning potentially coming back in, and then more rain later. And it's with that rain through this afternoon the winds here escalate. Gusts potentially up to 70 miles an hour, even inland. So we need to watch potentially for an amber warning here because of that. Obviously, it's going to cause disruption quite widely. For England and Wales, we already have the amber warnings in force for the southwest and for South Wales, where the ground is waterlogged after the autumn rain. So we could well see dangerous flood conditions on some of the roads. Already on the faster routes across England and Wales, lots of spray, standing water, large puddles. So dangerous conditions out here. The heavy rain currently across central and eastern areas will ease perhaps a little, but heavy showers following and more longer spells of rain later. But the winds escalate again quite widely, 50, 60 miles an hour, even inland. I should say it's mild, but it's inconsequential, really.
Helen, thank you very much for that. We will keep you up to date with that troublesome weather this morning. Let's turn, though, first of all, as we always do at this time, 6:09, for a look at the morning's papers, a number of them carrying photos of Keir Starmer this morning with the Ukrainian, French and German leaders. They met for talks yesterday in Downing Street. The Times is reporting that a deal to release up to £100 billion of frozen Russian assets in Europe, which could be used to help Ukraine with the war or with reconstruction afterwards. The paper says that is only days away, apparently. It says the money is one of the few cards that the Europeans have to use in negotiations with Washington.
And the Daily Telegraph reports that Donald Trump's peace plan could be on the brink of collapse because of President Zelensky's insistence that Ukraine has no obligation to cede territory to Russia. It says that Kiev will send a Europe-backed counterproposal to the US president later today.
The Financial Times claims that the former Labour Prime Minister, Sir Tony Blair, is no longer being considered for Donald Trump's so-called Board of Peace in Gaza after objections from Arab and Muslim states. The paper says that the opposition is in part because of his support for the US-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. But a source close to Sir Tony Blair has told the BBC that actually that main board will be made up of serving world leaders, so he wouldn't qualify for it anyway, but will sit instead on a smaller executive committee.
Migrants crossing the Channel in small boats are bringing heroin into Britain on behalf of people smugglers, according to an investigation carried out by The Telegraph. It says asylum seekers are being offered free or cut price crossings from northern France if they swallow packets of Class A drugs and deliver them to organised criminal gangs. The paper says it's shared its findings with the Home Office.
And most of the papers this morning carry photos of the Queen visiting the studios in Bristol, where the second series of the Disney Plus hit Rivals is being filmed at the moment. Camilla was famously good friends with the late Dame Jilly Cooper, who wrote the book that the TV series is based on. The Mirror reporting this morning that the Queen told the cast she binge-watched the first series while she was recovering from pneumonia. The Express says Dame Jilly herself had confirmed that the book's Lothario, Rupert Campbell Black, was inspired by her friend Andrew Parker Bowles, the Queen's ex-husband.
6:11, it's the time. A police review into the Army's top spy in the IRA is being published today, though in censored form. Chris Page is our Ireland correspondent. This is Operation Canova, isn't it? We've had interim reports. I feel we've discussed this with you on quite a few occasions in recent years. What are we learning today, Chris? What are we expecting to learn that we haven't been told before?
Yeah, this is the final report of Operation Canova, which is a police review carried out into several aspects of the conflict known as the Troubles in Northern Ireland. But the one that has certainly received the most attention is the activities of the Army's top spy in the IRA. He was codenamed Steak Knife. He was Freddie Scapaticci from West Belfast. He was head of what was known in the IRA as its internal security squad. So his job was to find people who were suspected of being informants for the security forces, and they were very often tortured and then killed. But Scapaticci himself was working as a spy for the army. Now, we know he was Freddie, the Steak Knife was Freddie Scapaticci. That's not, we understand, going to be in the final report of Operation Canova because of a long-standing government policy, government and security policy, that they don't confirm or deny the identity of informers. So the Canova team have pushed for permission to name Scapaticci officially for the first time, but that is not likely to happen. Something that is going to be in the final report, though, we're led to believe, is that we're going to find out how he was recruited to work as a spy.
The point of naming him, though, I mean, it's not just to have the freedom to do it, is it? For a lot of the families, it's important.
Yes, that's right. The families have really had to wait a very long time for this. Operation Canova has been nearly 10 years in the making. The truth about Steak Knife and what he did has really been one of the most difficult aspects of the Troubles to uncover, and it is a very murky conflict on the whole. Informers, people who were told by the IRA that they were informers, well, there was a huge stigma around them during the Troubles. These families felt that they had to remain silent, many of them, for many, many years. Another aspect of the report, too, which will generate a lot of attention, I think, today, is a subsection known as Operation Denton, which looks at the activities of a loyalist group of paramilitaries that operated out of a farm in County Armagh near the village of Glen Ann in the 1970s. It's alleged that police officers and soldiers from the Ulster Defence Regiment, locally recruited soldiers, were in that gang, and that group is suspected of carrying out around 120 murders. So the detectives from Operation Canova have been looking into the extent to which loyalist paramilitaries colluded with state forces in those murders.
And we'll be talking to the investigative reporter John Ware at 10 to 8. Chris Page, thanks.
It's 14 minutes past six now. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky will continue his meetings with European leaders today, shoring up support in the face of a US-backed peace proposal that, in its first iteration at least, heavily favoured Russia. Joel Gunter is our reporter in Kyiv. Joel, what do we know about how those talks in London went yesterday?
Well, it's a little bit of a mixed picture. It was obviously a very important moment for President Zelensky and for Ukraine, coming off the back, as it did, of that unexpected, slightly off-the-cuff interjection from President Trump, in which he criticised Zelensky personally and sort of implied again that it was Zelensky who was the obstacle to this peace process. So it was an important moment for the Ukrainians to have that visual solidarity in London yesterday. What Ukraine needs, of course, is security guarantees. What it's after is concrete, legally binding guarantees that would bring, ideally, the US back into the war and Europe back into the fight, I should say, if Russia decided to invade again. On that question, President Zelensky, speaking to reporters last night, said that there had been progress on security guarantees with the European partners, but he still had no answer on the details of that. And with President Trump's remarks and recent moves by the US, the American commitment to those security guarantees is a little bit of a question mark.
Joel Gunter in Kyiv, thank you.
16 minutes past six, the US is in the midst of a media takeover drama that is itself binge-watchable. Donald Trump, now involved, is saying that neither Netflix nor Paramount are great friends of his. Those two entertainment giants going head-to-head to try to claim the prize of Warner Brothers, their studios, their content as well. Sean is monitoring it all. Morning,
yes,
Sean.
Yes, in the latest episode, Justin, not only have we heard that Netflix initially won that auction for Warner Brothers Discovery's film and streaming business in that deal worth £50 billion, talking a lot about that yesterday. Now, this rival bidder, Paramount Skydance, has gone hostile. So they've brought in an offer worth more than £80 billion for the entire Warner Brothers business. They've put that offer directly to shareholders. And when we say entire business, that means it includes the network TV, the news assets that actually under a Netflix deal would be spun off or part of the plan. Now, Donald Trump, those comments that neither Netflix nor Paramount are great friends of his, maybe he's thinking he has to make those comments because Paramount Skydance is backed and run by the Ellison family, one of the world's richest men, Larry Ellison, of course, close ally of Donald Trump. Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, one of the financial partners of Paramount. So how does this impact things? Guy Petty is a former executive vice president at Paramount, where, amongst other things, he managed to negotiate partnerships with streaming services like Netflix. He's now head of the consultancy firm Fulcrum Media. Guy, thank you for joining us. I'll get on to what Paramount might actually do with Warner Brothers in a moment. But just first, these latest lines from Donald Trump, the relationship with the Ellison family. How does that impact the way all this plays out?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly. It's an interesting, obviously, it's great newsworthy and very kind of the shiny object in this this transaction. But I don't believe it'll actually come into play when the real approvals go through for either one of these companies, or companies Netflix or Paramount. It's going to be interesting to see how our antitrust department actually defines what the market is, and if this transaction is actually anti-competitive.
So yeah, when we talk about the antitrust, it's is it good for consumers, good for the industry that these deals get done. And when you say look at what the market is, are you saying, is this about streaming or is this about filmmaking? Is this about watching films in the cinema? What is the media and this kind of content production about these days?
Yeah, and that's the issue everyone I think will need to define. Is it all media that competes for everyone's attention? And that would be streaming, cable, broadcast, gaming, you know, even reading. All competes for the consumer's attention. So that'd be a very broad definition. And then under that case, I think it wouldn't matter who, you know, acquired. Because, you know, as an example, Netflix has maybe about 9% of the viewing in the market. YouTube is actually the largest streaming platform.
And we've talked quite a lot about that. How do Paramount do, and since Netflix had that bid, we've looked at that Netflix case. Given your experiences at Paramount, how would what they might do with the Warner Brothers Discovery portfolio be any different? What would they bring?
Well, I think the biggest difference, obviously, is those Warner Brothers cable assets or linear channels. It's something that, you know, Paramount has stated that they will keep their legacy networks, whereas NBC Universal, Comcast, and Warner Brothers right now want to spin those assets off. So Paramount has decided to go with more of the Disney strategy. Let's keep those linear assets. And Warner's Brothers Discovery has a lot of those assets. And that would just give Paramount much more scale in that area of the business.
And what about, you know, having worked there as you have done, the way the Ellison family run things at Paramount, now Paramount Skydance, and the boss of the business from the Ellison family, backed by the money, of course, of that family. What are they trying to achieve with this?
You know, that actually predates my tenure predates them coming out, you know, making the acquisition. But what I do think it does do for these, you know, media moguls, if you will, being more of a family, is they have a very long-term view and they have very deep pockets. So they have those financial resources to stay the course. Whatever course they decide to pick, I think they've got those resources to manage that course. Whereas, you know, something that's not under control by a family or a very strong owner, it's more financially controlled, like a Warner Brothers, is always in play.
How long till this deal gets done one way or another, Guy? Put you on the spot.
I think it's done probably in another month's time.
Oh, right.
You know, okay. At least close, and it's going to take another 18 months to get all the approvals or so.
Yeah, right. So there could be we can have a second series of the box set as we go through all the approvals as well. But this first series can be done in a few weeks. Guy Petty, former Executive Vice President at Paramount, thank you very much for your time. Right, we're going to be speaking to the Transport Secretary later on the programme about what Great British Railways is going to be all about. And as the Railways Bill gets its second reading in Parliament today, the idea of bringing infrastructure, most passenger services under government control being the plan, it's going to also pave the way for the creation of the government's own digital ticketing service. So effectively having all those different franchises we see it now when they're under the government control, all on one website, all on one app, competing directly with the likes of Uber, Trip and Trainline. And I've got Jodie Ford with me, who is the chief executive of Trainline. Jodie, thanks for joining us. How do you view the Railways Bill?
Good morning, Sean. Look, I think it's an important milestone in the creation of Great British Rail, and the government want to create a reliable, efficient rail service. That's got to be a good thing for UK rail customers. But I think beyond the reliable and efficient, what's important here is that innovation continues to be delivered to all of the rail customers. And therefore, for Trainline, it's critical that government deliver on its commitment to a fair and open market for third-party retailers like ourselves, as you say, like Uber and TrainPal.
What does that mean? Because since the announcement of this bill and the fact that there'd be a rival government service, the share price of Trainline has fallen a fair bit, this being held as one of the reasons for that. So how does it impact you?
Yeah, I think the CMA probably put it best. They called for early signal on a commitment to a level playing field. And that's just come through in the consultation. What does that really mean to your question? That means that all the products and all the services available, not to just GBR customers, but to Trainline customers, to Uber customers. And that might be something like delay repay. Right now, LNER customers can get one-click delay repay. We don't see why Trainline customers shouldn't have access to the same service. And then I think this idea is important around economic separation. When the French went through the same process a few years ago, what they did was take out the retail division of the SNCF, put that in a separate area. And that ensures that there's no effective subsidies going through into that website and ticketing app, which is, I think, good for ensuring fair competition, which is great for customers, but also ensures that taxpayer money isn't unfairly subsidizing and competing with British or other industry.
Is one of the reasons, you know, there's a perhaps a need for this app from the government? Because we've seen, you know, websites like yourself over the years charge fees, been criticised by some of our most high-profile consumer websites about Trainline charging fees and the potential to have fees on some of your tickets that you're buying that you just wouldn't get if you bought through other means.
Look, we think competition is really good. We use those, and we don't charge fees on the day. We charge a small fee for an advanced purchase, and we use those fees to invest in great innovation, whether that's split save, rail cards, price prediction. Just this week, we've launched a whole suite of disruption services to help you understand if your train is disrupted.
But with a simplification, sorry to interrupt you, with the idea of a simplification of the ticketing industry, anybody making a long distance journey around the UK would, you know, will know that it's not necessarily straightforward to get the best deal. Some of that might not be needed anymore if it is all on one site that can just give you the best price straight up.
Well, that's what Trainline has always done, and that's why we have 18 million customers who continue to come back. And we do think simplification will be helpful, but there's always, like any, we work across Europe, we sell 7 million customers in Europe, and we see that there's complexity in every rail service because you've got on-peak, off-peak, because you've got London loading, because you've got rail cards for many different routes, and actually helping navigate that, like in many other industries, a service that's on your side that is highly trusted, like Trainline is, to help you find the best fare and help you disrupt. We think it's a really strong proposition. And when GBR comes at some point in the coming years, we look forward to that competition. We think competition is important. It just has to be fair competition, or else that's bad for customers and bad for, in this case, UK tech business.
Can you envisage a time if the Trainline might not be in the UK if all this plays out as is intended with the bill at the moment?
We've been around 25 years. We have 80 million customers who come back regularly because of that innovation we continue to drive. And I think customers will keep coming back to that, as are French, Italian and Spanish customers.
Jody Ford, Chief Executive of Trainline, thank you very much for your time. Just wanted to check in with Louise Dudley, Global Equities Portfolio Manager for Federated Hermes. Louise, morning. The Magnum Ice Cream Company had its first day on the stock markets, spun out of Unilever. What was the mood? Is this something you wanted to mop up?
Yeah, so it did actually move positively, but it came through at a kind of an overall cheaper valuation than it was certainly touted a number of months ago. Couple of things coming in because of how it's listed. There are certain investors who will need to sell it because if it's not part of certain benchmarks and things like that. So that is a kind of downward pressure. But overall, relative to the rest of Unilever, actually seen as quite a relatively higher growth area. So it's a segment that has around 3-5% sales growth going forward. It certainly has the potential to move more into emerging markets, gain consumers through there. But one of the things is, you know, as it is obviously less diversified than the other kind of more global Unilever business, it is subject to more commodity volatility. There's also currency risk. But overall, we do view it positively. And as I said, it did move positively yesterday. And we'll see how much those kind of forced sellers weigh on the price in the near term.
Interesting.
Unilever does maintain a stake as well for 5 years. So that's something else that will add some stability to the price.
Louise, thank you. Louise Dudley there from Federated Hermes. I'll be back after 7 o'clock.
Good stuff. Thank you, Sean. It's 28 minutes past 6.
sports now. Carthy's here with the sport. Morning.
Morning. Thank you very much. The Liverpool forward Mo Salah has been left out of the squad for tonight's Champions League match at Inter Milan. Salah had said he feels he has been thrown under the bus after being dropped to the bench for Liverpool's last three games. Comments that have surprised the Liverpool manager, Arne Slot, who has explained his decision not to include Salah tonight.
Usually I'm calm and polite, but that doesn't mean I'm weak. If a player has these comments about so many things, then it's about me, us as a club to react. And we reacted in a way you can see now that he's not here.
Well, this commentary of Inter Milan versus Liverpool on 5 Live from 8 p.m. Chelsea are away at Atalanta and Tottenham host Slavia Prague in the Champions League, with the Spurs boss Thomas Frank keen to build some momentum after their win over Brentford.
Very important one, playing at home. So far we have a perfect record. Can we continue that? 3 points will be a massive step in the first bit, that is to qualify for the playoff rounds. If and when, hopefully, we qualify for that, then we can look further ahead after that.
Well, last night, Manchester United thrashed Wolves 4-1. Wolves remain bottom of the Premier League table, while United are now in sixth place. But this was the United manager Ruben Amorim's reaction when asked about his side moving up the table.
Nothing. Because everything is connected, and again, it's always the same feeling that we should have more points in this moment, but that is in the past. Let's focus on the future.
The draw for the third round of the FA Cup has resulted in some intriguing encounters, including sixth-tier side Macclesfield hosting FA Cup holders Crystal Palace and fellow sixth-tier side Western Supermare, who have reached this stage of the competition for the first time in their 138-year history. They will travel to League Two's Grimsby. And after he achieved his lifetime's ambition by winning the Formula One World Championship, the British driver Lando Norris says he's looking forward to switching off, forgetting all about the year and forgetting even that he drives in Formula One after overcoming his own self-doubt to win his first world title.
I just never thought at times that it was possible. So for me to then do that for myself, to kind of go, you're wrong, you can do it, it's a pretty incredible feeling to have for yourself. And I wouldn't say I'm a very selfish person, but I think I've also learned at times I almost have to be more selfish with some of these feelings and thoughts, and I need that to almost make me a better and stronger driver.
And Danny, you did a lovely interview yesterday with Lando Norris's childhood karting coach about sibling rivalry and how that helped Lando to get to where he is. So we'll be looking at the psychology of that in the next hour, not just because I'm a second child.
Well, so this is the interesting thing, because he said, didn't he, that he Lando always had somebody to chase.
Yeah.
There was always that mark that was just a little bit ahead of him to go for.
So we'll be looking at that in the next hour, because Andy Murray, Serena Williams, Usain Bolt, there are lots of them.
Interesting. Thank you, Carthy.
Make family time stress-free this Christmas with CBeebies Parenting. There's loads of things to do. Simple recipes to try together and activities to keep your little one learning as they play. Games with your favourite characters.
You can also use these buttons.
And, of course, all the shows you can watch together.
This is amazing!
Share some magic moments this Christmas. CBeebies Parenting. Here when you need us. Search CBeebies Parenting.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Justin Webb. It is 29 minutes to 7 and Jane Steele has the news.
The head of a national review into NHS maternity care in England says she's been shocked by what she describes as the repeated experiences of trauma endured by women and families. In an interim report, Baroness Amos says they continue to be let down by a lack of basic care and empathy, despite hundreds of recommendations made after inquiries into maternity services in the past decade. Australia's new law banning young teenagers from some of their favourite social media platforms comes into force today. Companies that fail to take reasonable steps to prevent under-16s from opening accounts could face fines of up to £25 million. Cambodia and Thailand say they've launched fresh strikes against each other as their long-running border dispute again flares into deadly conflict. Thailand says three of its soldiers have been killed. Cambodia says two more civilians have been killed in overnight shelling, bringing the total deaths on its side to 7. A revolutionary gene therapy has successfully treated patients with aggressive and previously incurable blood cancers. The treatment, developed by scientists at Great Ormond Street Hospital and University College London, edits the DNA of white blood cells into what's being called a living drug. A report out today is expected to say that rapidly designed COVID support programmes created a golden opportunity for fraudsters, contributing to taxpayer losses of almost £11 billion. The furlough scheme and Eat Out to Help Out are included in the review. A number of weather warnings have come into force in parts of Wales, Scotland and southwest England as Storm Bram sweeps across the UK. The Met Office says the storm could lead to damage to homes and buildings, flooding, power cuts and significant travel disruption. The winner of this year's prestigious Turner Art Prize will be announced tonight at a ceremony in Bradford. Naina Kalu, who's 27, is the second youngest artist to be nominated after Damien Hirst. Mohamed Sami, Zaidi Char and Rene Matic are also in the running for the prestigious accolade.
Thank you, Jane. It's 27 minutes to seven now. The chair of a review into maternity care in England has said in her first reflections, which come ahead of the publication of its findings early next year, that what she found was much worse than she anticipated. Baroness Amos called the scale of unacceptable care across the country extremely concerning. Well, we'll speak to her at 8:10 this morning. Michael Buchanan is our social affairs correspondent. Michael, good morning. Just tell us a little more about what Baroness Amos has had to say.
Good morning. Yes, well, the Baroness Amos was asked by Wes Street and the Health Secretary for England to chair this review in the summer, and sort of 3 months into it, what she's publishing this morning are her reflections on what she has seen during visits to seven NHS trusts and meetings with quite a number of families as well. And these are effectively the emerging consensus of the problems as she sees them. She says that women are not being listened to, not being given the right information, not being listened to, for instance, when they report that there's reduced fetal movements, fathers are not feeling supported when they go into a labour ward alongside their partners. Poor women, black women, Asian women, they get worse care than white women do. There's a lack of empathy, care and apology when things go wrong. Women often feel when a baby dies, for instance, that they have been blamed or that they are left to feel guilty because of what has happened, while the NHS organisations that are meant to be providing the safe care are meant to be learning after these incidents, they are left to mark their own homework. And what she says is that there have been three reviews into maternity care over the past decade in England, in Morecambe Bay, in Shrewsbury, in Telford and in East Kent. There's two ongoing, well, there's one ongoing in Nottingham. There's another one about to start in Leeds. There's been other inquiries as well. There are about 750 odd recommendations for improving maternity care within the NHS in England, but she says despite that, there are unacceptable levels of poor care, and she simply can't understand why things haven't improved given all the work that's gone on over the past decade.
Yeah, all of which will make people ask, Michael, is there any grounds to believe that this review will be any different?
Well, she says there is, and I asked her directly this yesterday when I spoke to her. I mean, the families who've been harmed are just, they believe they've heard this stuff over and over again. In her view, the fact that Wes Streeting has launched this review is going to chair a task force that he has committed will to implement in the recommendations when she publishes them from her final report in the spring. She says that will make a difference. It will be national recommendations and they will be implemented. It's fair to say there's a lot of scepticism that will happen from a number of families who've been harmed by poor maternity care. She knows this. There's criticism of the approach. There's a lot of families believe that this is a limited review, but the direction of travel is to get to these recommendations in the summer. And there are some families who believe, for instance, one campaigner I was speaking to yesterday says this could be the best chance in a decade to improve maternity care. So there is scepticism, there is a little bit of hope, but it'll all be what happens in the next couple of years. In 2 or 3 years' time, will maternity care in England be noticeably safer? And that will be the true and frankly the only test of whether this review was the right approach for Mr. Streeting to take or not.
Thank you, Michael. Michael Buchanan, and we'll put some of those thoughts to Baroness Amos a little later in the programme.
23 minutes to seven is the time. At lunchtime today, our time, the middle of the night in Australia, a social experiment begins, a social media ban for the under-16s. Katie Watson is our Australia correspondent and is on the line. It's a ban, though, with some holes, isn't it?
It is indeed. I think some of the biggest holes are the fact that it's a bit of a whack-a-mole game. There are 10 platforms, including the likes of Instagram, TikTok, Snapchat. They've been targeted to be restricted as of tomorrow my time. And they, but the fact is, this is going to evolve. That's exactly what the government has said. It's not a cure, it's a treatment plan. It might even be a bit of a messy rollout, but it's about targeting and protecting kids from harmful content, cyberbullying, predatory algorithms. So it will be a question of watching and seeing what are the platforms that perhaps present the biggest risk. But of course, the likes of gaming, that is an exclusion, and that worries a lot of parents because the feeling is that they share a lot of similarities with social media. Messaging is also off limits, so kids will still be able to message one another on many other platforms.
And those social media platforms that are found, if any are, to be in breach of these new rules, what happens to them?
Yeah, so they have to take what the legislation says is are reasonable steps to make sure that under 16s don't open an account, don't stay on the social media platforms. If they don't, then they face fines of up to $50 million Australian dollars. That's about £25 million. But as critics have pointed out, the likes of Meta probably earn that in a matter of hours. So the question is, will that be a deterrent? But certainly I was speaking to the communications minister last week who said it may be, you know, there is that view of will they just cop the fine and carry on, but they will not be complying with the law in operating here in Australia. And of course, that's not a good look either. So all the companies so, you know, have said that they will comply. They don't agree with the ban, but they will obviously work together with the government to keep people safe.
Katie Watson, thank you.
It's 21 minutes to seven.
The former Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, spoke in the Commons last night about the Employment Rights Bill and expressed, it is fair to say, some frustrations about its delay.
I'm really pleased that we've got to this point now. I'm frustrated by the delay that we've had. So I welcome what my honourable friend, the Minister, and her contribution and the Secretary of State for getting us this far. And hopefully those on the opposite benches will no longer frustrate what was a key manifesto pledge from us. And
Let's talk to Henry Zeffner, Chief Political Advisor. What there is she talking about, Henry?
Well, this has been bogged down in the House of Lords for a while, Justin. And to unlock that, the government a few weeks ago made a fairly significant concession, which was that after convening talks between unions and some business groups, they agreed to soften plans to give workers protection from unfair dismissal upon their first day of employment. But there has been some concern among Labour MPs around that, given it was a manifesto commitment. So the government has defended it on the grounds that it was vital to unlock a stalemate in the House of Lords and that many trade unions and many business groups are on board with it. But another point in Angela Rayner's speech, it did feel like there was a warning to the government. She said this is not the time to blink or buckle. I'm interpreting that as a warning shot against making further concessions. And that's important, not just because there's a little bit of the legislative process still to go, but also because the way the legislation is constructed means that elements of how it will work in practice are still set to go out to public consultation. So there's still quite a lot of potential for disagreement within the Labour Party on how to proceed with this.
Meanwhile, the Liberal Democrats want us to be back in a European Union customs union and are taking that fight to the Commons today. What, to a vote or what?
Well, probably not. This is a 10-minute rule bill, which is a piece of parliamentary procedure, which means the Liberal Democrats will get to give a speech advocating for the UK to join the EU's customs union. There probably won't be a vote, and there's not going to be some protracted debate, although let's see on the vote matter. But what it is, I think, is the Lib Dems trying to pick at a fairly open sore within the Labour Party, an increasingly one, in fact. I mean, there was a lot of interest last week in comments by Sir Keir Starmer, which appeared to indicate, in fact, called for further measures to bring the UK back closer to the EU. It all felt pretty suggestive. Now, I wrote a piece for the BBC website saying that actually there was less to all that than first met the eye. It turned out what Keir Starmer was really getting at was just strands of negotiation which are underway already, which were announced as part of the UK-EU summit earlier this year. And he's reiterated that he's still committed to the UK staying outside the single market and outside the customs union. But
just to make it plain what the customs union is and why he doesn't want to be part of it. So you can be outside the EU and be in the customs union. Turkey is, isn't it, for some things. And it means you have a common external tariff. But crucially, I suppose, you don't have a tariff between nations. So you trade really freely in goods inside the EU. That would be the attraction.
Exactly right. And there's two attractions for that in some within the Labour Party. One is that they believe that lack of tariffs within the European Union and anyone else in that customs union is a way to secure the all elusive economic growth. And the other attraction for some within the Labour Party and Labour movement is they believe it is the right political move to rally progressives back around Labour. But Keir Starmer says he's still committed to the UK being outside the customs union, partly because it was a vow in Labour's general election manifesto to keep the UK outside the customs union. There are also various things that his government has done, not least free trade deals, which would no longer be possible if the UK were to re-enter the EU's customs union. And whatever happens today with this Liberal Democrat gambit, I think the people within the Labour Party who are calling for that are going to become more vocal in the coming months.
We'll be hearing directly from the Lib Dems after 7 o'clock. Henry Zeffman, thank you.
It's 17 minutes to seven now. There was dismay from MPs on all sides yesterday in Parliament that 30 soldiers who'd been testing the new Ajax armoured vehicle on a recent military exercise had suffered illness and injury. A minister told them that three inquiries were now underway after he'd been assured that earlier problems with those vehicles had been solved. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Susan Hume.
A career in the armoured cavalry would never appeal to those of us who like a nice warm office and a coffee machine nearby. But even for someone who's always yearned to drive a tank, this sounds a bit beyond the call of duty.
How shocking it was to hear of the army exercise which took place on the 22nd of November that resulted in over 30 casualties among soldiers operating Ajax, with reports of symptoms ranging from sickness to hearing loss.
The Shadow Defence Secretary, James Cartledge. The Army's new Ajax armoured vehicle has been beset by problems. The programme to deliver it is years behind schedule, it's cost billions and it's been paused in the past in order for the manufacturer, General Dynamics, to sort out problems of excessive noise and vibration. That's why James Cartledge, who was a defence minister in the previous government, was feeling so shocked.
On a personal note, I imagine the minister is as furious as I am at having been repeatedly given what now turn out to be false assurances by those responsible for the Ajax programme. But surely he is now left with a binary choice, fix it or fail it.
The current Defence Minister Luke Pollard said he'd ordered three investigations into the problems. He sounded pretty angry too.
I too was disgusted when I heard the news of the injuries to our service personnel, especially after a point where the vehicle was assured to be safe. It is for that very reason that I'm not going to speculate, and I hope he understands the reason why, until the results of these investigations have reported, so we can understand what is the cause of these noise and vibration injuries, and then a decision can be made based on that information.
Labour's Tan Desi chairs the Commons Defence Committee.
What an absolute shambles, and the Minister should be livid at how things have transpired with the billions of pounds of British taxpayer money spent over the years on the Ajax programme, and now the injuries sustained by our brave service personnel.
So, given the delays and breakdowns affecting other sorts of armoured vehicles,
where exactly does this leave us with the British Army's readiness at a time of such increased international tensions?
With European leaders meeting President Zelensky in Downing Street even as they spoke, the minister agreed there were problems with defence procurement, but the government intended to get on top of that. Speaking for the Lib Dems, James McCleary said, rather ominously, that our allies and enemies would be watching closely. So what would happen if Ajax never worked properly?
The Ajax is now getting on for 9 years behind schedule. After more than £6 billion spent, ministers still cannot give a cast-iron guarantee that Ajax is safe to operate. So can the minister confirm whether the department has prepared any contingency plan should the Ajax ultimately be deemed unsafe or unviable?
Luke Pollard told him the price, £6.3 billion, had not changed since 2014. But as for the future,
we are bringing this saga to an end one way or another, and a decision will be made once it can be properly informed by the evidence of what has happened here.
Well, any hint that Ajax could be abandoned alarmed Labour's Ruth Jones.
Given the workers at the Oakdale site in my constituency are diligent and hardworking and Christmas is fast approaching, what assurances can the minister give me that defence jobs associated with this programme in Newport West and Islwyn and across South Wales are safe for the long term?
Luke Pollard made no promises, but said he understood the importance of those jobs in her community, and he stressed that he wanted the inquiries to get to the bottom of the problem.
I want to understand what has happened with those vehicles that caused injuries to our service personnel and why other vehicles from the same family of vehicles produced around the same time did not cause injuries to other service personnel.
Another Conservative, Sir Julian Lewis, still thought Ajax might not be fixable.
I really worry that if and when the decision has to be taken that this platform is not fit to be issued to our armed forces, there is going to be a huge legal standoff between the MOD and the company as to who is responsible for picking up the bill. Has thought been given to sharpening the pencils of the MOD lawyers?
Luke Pollard told him all options remained on the table, but hopefully the tank crews will be equipped with something better than a really sharp pencil.
That's Susan Hume reporting.
And it brings us to 12 minutes to 7. Should a young person do an apprenticeship or go to university? The government wants apprenticeships upgraded, has announced new investments, but there is a data set that might hugely help with the decision that people have to make. It is available, though not many people get to consult it. The database is called the Longitude Education Outcomes Database, and Fraser Nelson, the Times columnist, former editor of The Spectator, has written about it in the past and is on the line now. Morning to you, Fraser.
Morning, Justin.
Where is it?
Look, if you know where to look, it was a massive big data dump. Now, nobody can really read that. The Times recently came up with a reader, so you can actually put in your university, put in the course, and they can tell you how much typically of graduates are earning 1 year, 3 years, and 5 years after graduation. So if you did economics at LSE, you can be getting 68 grand after 5 years. If it's English at Durham, that's going to be like 35 grand. So that kind of difference. But there are lots of courses, about one in five, where the students would be better off having, financially better off, having never gone to university at all. It's a lot harder to find these things, but it's a lot harder to get information at all. And apprenticeships aren't listed. That's the problem, because they could be paying significantly more than a lot of degrees.
But could they be listed? I mean, the information is obviously there.
Absolutely. The government has the information. Leo is the most... what I refer to is the redacted database. It's an edited version, the only one that a handful of journalists have got access to. The full database, if they were to publish it, could let every student in the country know, when they're applying for their university degree, what the salary is associated with that and how it compares to a vocational degree. Now, if you ask me, the government has a duty to let every student know this when they're making their big decisions. Are they going to take on all this debt? Is the debt going to be worth it? What are the equivalents for apprenticeships, for engineering? So I think parity of esteem means parity of information, and the government should release all of this data.
Do you know why they haven't? Have you asked anyone?
Basically, this was a Tory idea to build the data. The Tories' idea was that this great data set, by the way, it's an incredible achievement. Everybody's tax records links to everybody's educational data, would create a market in education. So before people decide to invest or borrow in university, they'd work out, is it worth it? And the courses that weren't worth it, nobody would apply to them, or fewer people would, and there would be a proper market. That was the idea. That isn't in favour anymore amongst the current government. So politically, things go in fashion and out of fashion. When this was finished, it had fallen out of fashion, and people don't really promote it or make it available. But it is there.
Yeah, we just had Keir Starmer, haven't we, saying he wants apprenticeships to be viewed kind of as on a par with degrees, etc., and socially and economically and all the rest of it. You'd think it would be in their favour now to publish the thing.
Well, look, with one email, Keir Starmer could solve this. He could just tell the officials, I want you to release the whole Leo data set. Now, various companies would then make it readable for students. But if he were to release the files, then there are so many organizations out there who would absolutely show how much money can really be made in trade now or via apprenticeships, and show just how favorably these compare with a lot of rather ropey degrees which don't really serve students or society.
Fraser Nelson, thank you.
It's 8 minutes to seven. Ukraine insists that it's still resisting Russian advances in the city of Pokrovsk in eastern Ukraine. That is despite Russian claims last week that it's now taken control of the entire city. Pokrovsk has been a key battleground for more than a year now. Ukraine sees it as a major obstacle to preventing Russian forces from taking control of the entire Donetsk region. Well, our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale has been talking to Ukrainian troops who are still defending the city.
This is what it's like fighting in Pokrovsk. What the men of Ukraine's Skala assault regiment are facing. hiding from the constant menace of Russian drones. The threat that 48-year-old Hotabich had to endure for nearly 30 days.
It is scary when the drones spot you. There are a lot of drones there. They fly around the clock. We always wish for good weather, meaning fog or some rain. A grey sky, because at such times we could resupply and reinforce our positions. And the rest of the time we just sat there without going out, so that the drones wouldn't spot us.
His units coordinating the fight from a command center well behind the front line.
In this corridor, it's a hive of activity, rooms going off. Obviously different parts of the command, maps, computers, and up in this room, video feeds.
Ukrainian drones flying above Pokrovsk show a city in ruins, smoke rising across the horizon. But they want to prove Pokrovsk has not fallen, despite Russian claims to have taken the city. They want to demonstrate to me that it's not true.
They've been talking to their men on the ground in Pokrovsk to show us they are there still fighting. He's just giving orders for them to show their flag. And there it is. You can see it now. Just there.
The commander of the Skala regiment, Yuri, tells me it exposes another Kremlin lie, that Ukraine's lost Pokrovsk.
You've seen it with your own eyes. If we do not show this, the whole world will lose faith and stop helping the Ukrainian people, the Ukrainian army. That is why we are doing this, to prove we're still strong.
And you still have positions here?
Yes.
A staff officer, call sign Potapich, shows me where Ukrainian forces are still defending in the north of the city.
So there's a map here, a digital map, which has Ukrainian positions around Pokrovsk, and there are a few red spots, targets, that they're going to hit here, where Russian forces are present. But you can still clearly see from this map that Ukrainian troops are still in the city in numbers, we're told, hundreds.
This is Bankards, Russian.
So these are things you picked up on the battlefield?
Yeah. From the dead bodies.
You think you killed a lot of Russians in Pokrovsk?
Not enough.
A soldier whose call sign is Rabbit shows me more proof that the Russians are taking heavy casualties. Ukraine may be losing ground, but it's not giving up.
The idea about giving up land for peace, what do you say to that?
So much blood of Ukrainian people in this ground. So it will be a shame to give any part. If we will give some, Russia will take more.
The focus here is on the fight, not peace talks. But a Latvian volunteer, the unit's deputy commander, is willing to vent some frustration. His call sign is the Godfather, and he has a message for Europe and America.
I wish Steve Witkoff to be together with President Trump, who's a strong leader, and show that America is number one in military, and showing weakness to Russians is showing weakness of America and Trump. So, and I hope Trump is siding with democratic countries and with NATO countries. Europe is a lot of talking, a lot of bureaucracy, and a lot of empty talks and not enough doing.
The battle for Pokrovsk has been going on for more than a year now. How much longer can Ukraine hold on? It is losing ground. The city is in ruins. But Ukraine needs proof of its resolve at this critical time.
Jonathan Beale reporting from Ukraine.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife.
Marking the 250th anniversary of Jane Austen's birth.
She is the most engaging, interesting, witty, delightful person.
A selection of drama and documentaries celebrating her life, legacy, and literary brilliance.
It's just genius writing.
Every time I read it, it was like reading it for the first time.
Featuring Val McDermid, Tamsin Gregg, Emma Thompson, and more.
250 years of Jane Austen on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
7:03, there is some weather to watch out for today. Helen Willetts is here to tell us more. Morning, Helen.
Morning, Anna. Indeed there is, and all the warning details, because there are numerous, are on the website. But let me fill you in on the most extreme weather we expect from Storm Bram, because it will have far-reaching impacts and disruption. The amber rain warnings. Now, amber, just to remind you, means there is a potential danger to life. There's amber rain warnings this morning out for southwest England and for South Wales. Already we've had over 50 millimetres of rain falling in these areas through the night. There's more to come. And the rain is quite widespread this morning. There's lots of spray and standing water and large puddles on the roads, if not flooded roads. So aquaplaning clearly a concern, travel conditions difficult, lots of fog over the hills as well. That rain, heaviest rain now, making its way into northern Scotland, Northern Ireland, Northern and Eastern England. The rain's more fragmented behind, but it is heavy. So there's more to come, hence those rain warnings. Now, once that rain becomes more fragmented for Northern Ireland, the rest of England and Wales, and it parks itself across the north of Scotland with the heavy showers following on behind, the winds then really start to escalate. So it's a double whammy from our Storm Bram. We've the amber warning then kicking into place this afternoon across northwestern Scotland, gusts of up to 90 miles an hour, damaging gusts of wind, dangerous gusts of wind. So clearly it's going to be very windy in many parts with gales or severe gale force winds. Always most extreme in the north and the west. So concerns for Northern Ireland, where gusts of up to 70 miles an hour possible inland and across parts of Scotland, northwestern parts of England and Wales as well. So very windy, but equally very mild today. Temperature to potentially 15 or 16 degrees, but inconsequential really, as I say, because we've got all that heavy rain with Bram and those winds, which will stay strong across northwestern areas through the night as well. So stay tuned to the forecasts.
Helen, thank you for that. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Justin Webb.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 9th of December. The headlines this morning: the chair of a review into maternity care in England says she's shocked at what she's found, and nothing prepared her for the scale of unacceptable care received by some women and families. Baroness Amos Wiz will join us at 10 past eight. A social media ban for under-16s is coming into force in Australia. How will big tech respond, and could it have an impact here? We'll have more on that just after the news. And a report is expected to say that fraudsters targeting COVID support programmes cost taxpayers almost £11 billion.
Also in the next hour, aged just 13, Alyssa Tapley thought she was going to die from leukaemia. She became then the first person in the world to receive a revolutionary gene therapy treatment. Today she is cancer-free and she joins us in 20 minutes' time. Plus, a police review into the Army's top spy in the IRA, known as Steak Knife, publishes its final report this morning. The investigative reporter John Ware has been following the twists and turns of the case. He'll be with us. And
they're very small, they're really cute. And I said, how would that do in this country? And everyone seems to think good, but you're not allowed to build them. And I've authorized the secretary to immediately approve the production of those cars.
President Trump, always surprising, now seems to be in love with very small cars, Japanese K cars. Could this tiny vehicle provide a big solution for America's roads and indeed ours? The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
The head of a national review into NHS maternity care in England says she's been shocked by what she called the constant experiences of trauma that women and families have gone through across the country. In a report giving her initial findings, Baroness Amos says nothing prepared her for the scale of unacceptable treatment. She says families continue to be let down by a lack of basic care and empathy, despite hundreds of recommendations made after inquiries into maternity services in the past decade. Here's our social affairs correspondent, Michael Buchanan.
Baroness Amos was asked by the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, to chair a review looking at why so many families receive poor maternity care in England. She said consistent themes have already emerged: women being ignored and feeling blame for the deaths of their babies, while NHS organisations are viewed as marking their own homework when things go wrong. Class and colour matter too, with poor and black women often receiving worse care. Maternity staff also reported receiving death threats while working in poorly performing units. Previous inquiry, said Baroness Amos, had led to almost 750 recommendations for improving maternity care, yet still the harm continues. Wes Streeting has promised to implement the review's own recommendations when they're published in the spring.
A new law comes into force in Australia later today, banning young teenagers from some of their favourite social media platforms, including Snapchat, TikTok and Instagram. It's being touted as world-first legislation, and under the new rules, if companies fail to take reasonable steps to prevent under-16s from opening accounts, they could be fined up to £25 million. Our Australia correspondent Katie Watson reports from Sydney.
In Australia, Tuesday is almost over, supposedly the last day of digital freedom for the country's young teens. The new rules mean no more Snapchat or TikTok videos or liking of photos. Some of the most popular social media platforms will be off limits for under-16s. People here are calling it a ban. The government prefers to use the word delay, giving youngsters more time to grow up before being let loose on social media. Whatever the term, the majority of teens are not happy about it. Plenty of parents, on the other hand, see this as a show of support by the government, standing up to the big US tech companies who've been criticised for not doing enough in recent years to prevent online harm. Ministers say it's a treatment plan, not a cure. The rollout might be messy. It's certainly a novel experiment. The world will be watching to see if it works.
A revolutionary gene therapy has successfully treated patients with aggressive and previously incurable blood cancers. It involves editing the DNA of white blood cells to turn them into what's being called a living drug. The treatment has been developed by scientists at Great Ormond Street Hospital and University College London. The first of 11 patients treated 3 years ago remains cancer-free. More details from our medical editor, Fergus Walsh.
9 children and 2 adults with an aggressive form of leukemia have been treated with the pioneering gene therapy technique called base editing. This involved taking donor white blood cells and making precise changes to single bases, the building blocks of genetic code, among the billions in their DNA. The donor cells were modified so they would not attack the patient's body, but would target cancer cells. The results published in the New England Journal of Medicine show that 64% of the patients remain disease-free, including Alyssa Tapley, the first to be treated in 2022. Now 16, her ambition is to work in cancer research.
Cambodia and Thailand say they've launched fresh strikes against each other as their long-running border dispute again flares into deadly conflict. Cambodia says 2 more civilians have been killed in overnight shelling by Thai forces, bringing the total death on its side to 7. Thailand has reported that 2 more of its soldiers have been killed. Both sides have blamed each other for the clashes, which have derailed a fragile ceasefire brokered by President Trump in July. A police review into the Army's top spy in the IRA, known as Steak Knife, is to publish its final report. The findings are likely to include new information on how he was recruited. Detectives from the investigation called Operation Canova have also been examining the extent to which the security forces colluded with a loyalist paramilitary group in the 1970s. Here's our island correspondent, Chris Page.
The spy with the codename Steak Knife was widely believed to have been Freddie Scappaticci from West Belfast. He was in the IRA's internal security squad, which tortured and killed Irish Republicans who were suspected of being informants for the security forces. But Scappaticci himself was working as an agent for the British Army. He died in hiding in England 2 years ago. Operation Canova's interim report last year said the spy probably cost more lives than he saved. The final review, which will be published today, will also include the findings of the team's investigation into a group of loyalists who were based at a farm near the village of Glen Ann in County Armagh. They were suspected of carrying out 120 murders. Police officers and soldiers were alleged to have been members of the unit known as the Glen Ann Gang.
A number of weather warnings have come into force in parts of Wales, Scotland and southwest England as Storm Bram sweeps across the UK. The Met Office says the storm could lead to damage to homes and buildings, flooding, power cuts and significant travel disruption. In northwest Scotland, gusts of up to 90 miles per hour are forecast, while as much as 3 inches of rain is expected to fall widely across affected areas. A report out today is expected to say that rapidly designed COVID support programmes created a golden opportunity for fraudsters, contributing to taxpayer losses of almost £11 billion. The COVID Counter-Fraud Commissioner, Tom Hayhoe, was appointed a year ago to try to recover the money lost through schemes and underperforming contracts. Here's our business correspondent, Theo Leggett.
During the pandemic, as the country went into lockdown, the then Conservative government implemented a wide range of policies aimed at protecting businesses and safeguarding jobs. They included the furlough scheme, the self-employment income support scheme, and several loan programmes. Later, there were measures to help the economy recover, such as Eat Out to Help Out. While the Treasury's actions at the time have been widely credited with helping to mitigate the economic fallout from the pandemic, today's report is expected to say that rushed implementation and a lack of controls contributed to losses from fraud and error of £10.9 billion. The Commissioner has previously highlighted how pandemic-era contracts for protective equipment cost taxpayers £1.4 billion, which was spent on unusable gowns, masks and gloves. So far, only about £400 million has been recovered.
Senior firefighters have urged the public not to throw unwanted electronics into the rubbish this Christmas. The National Fire Chiefs Council says there's been a big rise in fires in bin lorries and recycling facilities caused by batteries, and people should recycle their electronic goods rather than throwing them away. Cricket, England's fast bowler Mark Wood has been ruled out of the remainder of the Ashes. He's flying home from Australia after suffering a recurrence of a left knee injury. Underwater archaeologists working off the coast of Alexandria in Egypt have discovered the wreck of a large ancient pleasure boat dating back 2,000 years to the 1st century AD. They believe the vessel would have had luxuriously decorated cabins and have been propelled by oars. Professor Frank Godio from the European Institute for Underwater Archaeology led the search team.
We have palaces, we have temples, but we have also shipwrecks. It's quite exciting when you come across a ship, you know, which has been described, but which has never been found before.
Professor Frank Godio speaking there.
It is 9 minutes past seven. Thank you, Jane. The world's first social media ban for teenagers comes into force in Australia today. It covers the biggest social media apps, things like TikTok, Instagram, Snapchat and YouTube. And it means that under 16s will not be able to set up new accounts. Existing ones will be shut down. There are questions about its potential effectiveness and whether it disregards the rights of children to use those platforms. But other countries around the world are watching closely to see if this will manage to do what it's designed to, protect children and help cut their screen time. Well, Australian teenagers have had plenty of time to think about the changes coming in. Some of them shared their views in Sydney.
From my perspective, it's kind of insulting to think that they don't trust me with the internet.
Social media isn't necessary. It's like a privilege we have.
To take away something, it kind of makes you want it even more.
What do you think of the under 16 social media ban?
I'm against it, but I get what they're trying to do.
I'm undecided.
I think that the ban is a great idea.
It will be very annoying, but I think I'll quickly get over it.
My whole family loves the idea of the ban, like loves it. They're obsessed with it. But I really disagree.
No real surprise in there. Zoe Kleiman is our technology editor. Morning, Zoe.
Morning.
We heard what Australian teens think. What about the big tech companies? What are they planning to do about this?
Well, it's been described by one former Facebook executive as social media's seatbelt moment, which I think is a really interesting way of looking at this. I think it's fair to say that the companies affected, as you say, it's the big ones, TikTok, Meta, X, Snapchat, YouTube. They are not very happy about it. They think, they argue that it is disconnecting children, that it's, not going to help them with their digital literacy as adults, and that it's not helping them to stay connected with the international communities that they've met via online. It's certainly going to be a very different Christmas holiday, isn't it, for the hundreds of thousands of teenagers which these firms say are on their platforms at the moment having accounts. The ban's had a lot of support from adults and parents, and teenagers, as you heard there, have rather more mixed views about it, but some of them have been sharing tips about how to get around it. One told us at the BBC that holding up a photo of her mum for the age verification worked. obviously the tech giants dispute this. I think it's important to say that they have to take reasonable steps to ensure that the ban is working. There's also been criticism that the fine, the penalty that the Australian government is threatening is £25 million, which really isn't a lot for a tech giant in the US. Somebody compared it to being a bit like a parking fine. And other critics say, of course, the danger is it's going to push children to other parts of the internet which aren't banned. And then, of course, there's a lot of discussion around what is on the banned list and what isn't, because messaging and gaming apps have been left off. Roblox, for example, WhatsApp, Discord, none of them are on it. And yet, you know, there are lots of cases where they've also been used to generate online harms like grooming and bullying for younger people.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot still to watch, isn't there? Thank you, Zoe. Zoe Kleinman there, our technology editor. Kate Edgecombe-Rendell is with us as well, a mum of three boys here in the UK. Hello, Kate.
Hello, good morning.
When you look at what's happening in Australia, does it, because obviously it's not happening here just yet, does it change the way that you perceive social media? Will it change the way that, because your boy's a little bit younger. I think the oldest one's just getting towards it now.
Exactly. I think, you know, it's all eyes on Australia, really. And I think there'll be many parents cheering on the sidelines hearing this news this morning. Personally, my view is that it should be banned for under 16s. I don't see there is a place for social media in our young people's lives. You only have to go into a school to see some of the issues that they are dealing with. So for me personally, this isn't about being anti-tech. This is about being pro-childhood. And social media doesn't enable our children to get the best out of their childhood.
Will it work? It is a big question, because it has an impact. But then obviously you see in this country things that are supposed to be banned for people under a certain age, smoking, drinking, all of that. If they want to, they get around it.
I mean, it's a really good question. You know, teenagers will be teenagers. And it'll be interesting to see how Australia kind of iron out the creases. I mean, I think in theory it should work, but there's going to be having to be a lot of heavy policing from all sides of this, including from us as parents. I think we have a responsibility to make sure that our children are behaving sensibly and properly online. So therefore, parents will have to be much more involved in this process. So I like to think it works. It will work. But who knows? But I think this is a really, really positive step in the right direction.
What about, and there's some teenagers, and we heard a bit of it when we heard from some of those teenagers in Sydney, and they say, well, we need to learn these things. We need to spread our wings online. Is it something we should just be dumped into when we get to 16? I mean, look, children will make all sorts of compelling arguments to try and convince us. What do you think about that one?
I think digital literacy is imperative in our society, and obviously we want them to have some understanding of how the internet and their online worlds work. So this isn't about, as I said, this is not about being anti-tech, but I think lots of the stuff that is thrown at our young people through social media is not necessarily what we want them to be seeing. So that's kind of my stance on it.
Yeah. And presumably if it came in here, it would clearly be something that you would be very supportive of.
Absolutely. I mean, I work in schools, so I see the kind of firsthand effect quite regularly. And we, you know, there's huge amounts of issues with our young people. We have problems with body image, well-being, you know, everything. So I think absolutely it's something that we will be supportive of. I think the effects are too vast for us not to really have a look at it in depth.
Yeah. It's something we'll talk more about after 8 o'clock. Thank you, Kate Edgecombe-Rendell. It is a debate. And I think no doubt people will be watching very closely what does happen in Australia and seeing what lessons can be learned one way or another elsewhere.
16 minutes past six is the time. Britain needs to rejoin the EU customs union, so say the Liberal Democrats. They take that message to the Commons today. The customs union does extend to some non-member states, including Turkey. It's also possible, as Turkey does, to be in the union for some things but not others. If you're in, you get a common external tariff and no tariffs, no barriers to trade at all with other members within the union, at least in goods. Al Pinkerton is the Liberal Democrats to Europe spokesperson and is on the line. Morning to you.
Hi, good morning, Justin.
What would the benefit be to us?
Well, we know that there are people up and down this country who are economically struggling with the cost of living crisis, with food price inflation and energy price inflation. And I speak to businesses all the time who are just doing enough to get by right now, but who are looking for better times ahead. And those are big businesses and small. And what we need, of course, in this country is a vast new amount of economic growth. That's what the government got elected to deliver. Now, given that so much of the economic stagnation that we face right now has been caused as a consequence of Brexit. We know this because the National Bureau of Economic Research has shown that our economy is today between 6 and 8% smaller than it might otherwise have been. We need to pull the lever. And the lever at our disposal here is to join a UK-EU customs union that would get Britain exporting again, get British businesses growing again, and alleviate, therefore, so many of the economic challenges that we face.
What would it actually change? Because, I mean, there isn't a tariff on goods at the moment, is there, from us to the EU? What actually changes if we join the customs union?
Well, there's so much paperwork that's generated at the moment. So I have a business in my constituency called Crocus. They're the UK's largest exporter and retailer of plant goods. The paperwork that's been generated as a consequence, and indeed the cost, therefore, in producing that paperwork, is absolutely crippling. So I speak to big businesses and small. There are other major multinationals who tell me that they're looking to lift and drop fantastic ideas that have been developed in the UK into continental Europe because there's a far better chance of allowing those parts of their enterprises to grow in continental Europe. We've put up these barriers on ourselves, and it's absolutely imperative that we allow British businesses to grow again.
What about the cost? So we would then be in the same boat as the EU when it came to trade arrangements around the world, including with some countries that we've done our own deals with and actually better deals than the EU has.
Well, what we know is that the Australia and New Zealand deals, for example, those are two of the new deals that have been done, add 0.1% to GDP, a GDP uplift that's so small, not even the OBR would be willing to talk about it.
Right, and the United States and India and the others?
Well, those are still being negotiated. But what we also know is that the tariff arrangements imposed by the United States is so capricious, so changing right now. The estimate suggests that the India deal is about 0.1%, just over 0.1% to GDP, whereas 50% of our trade is done with the European Union. We know that if the government even stuck within their own red lines, there could be a £25 billion a year boost to the exchequer, £25 billion extra that could be spent on vital services or increasing defence spending, for example. A customs union would take us well beyond that.
Brief,
and that would just
thought,
go a long way to recover our economy.
There are one or two Labour MPs, I could imagine, probably nodding along as they're hearing you. Are you going to get Labour support today? Or is anyone coming out and going to be public, do you think?
Well, I certainly hope so. I've been certainly speaking to lots of Labour MPs, but also non-Labour MPs as well, even some from the Conservative benches, who recognise that this is absolutely vital. This is the only lever that we have got that the government can pull that can generate the kind of economic growth that people will actually be able to feel by the time of the next election. And that is absolutely imperative, because if we don't have that feeling, then people may choose to vote for something really quite deplorable.
Al Pinkerton, thank you.
It's 20 past seven. Confidence in hiring new staff has rebounded for the first time in 6 months, according to recruiters. Sean Farrington is back with more. Hello again, Sean.
Hi, Anna. Yeah, these recruiters are Manpower, and in their latest monthly survey, they found that more keenness to hire from those in the tech, construction, manufacturing sectors have seen the first overall growth in confidence for half a year, though confidence levels still a fair bit down from where they were a year ago. Petra Tagg is a director at Manpower. Petra, morning. Is this a one-month blip, or does this tally with a genuine change in confidence, do you think?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is it is a genuine uptick in confidence. For the last 12 months, what we've seen is a gradual decline quarter on quarter across many of the sectors. And it's quite pleasing to see for the first time that we have upticked in our data for 2 percentage points, as you've rightly said. But just to balance that is still down 16 points compared with the same quarter in Q1 of this year. So we still need to be quite cautious, but we are seeing some positive upticks in a number of sectors, as you said.
So why? Yeah, why have these sectors found this confidence after such a run of hiring, sort of lack of confidence?
Yeah, so over the last 12 months, sectors have continued to hire, particularly in the IT space, which has been driven by the surge in AI. And, you know, that's changed the dynamics of many hiring strategies. Construction is a key focus area at the moment, with investment in housing and other opportunities. And that's leading to the opportunities for skilled workers. So we're seeing that continue. It has grown from a percentage point. Construction is up 24%. So that is standing out as the strongest sector this quarter.
And these questions asked after the budget, were they?
Yes, and I think it's important to point out, in terms of the confidence levels, that this is a forward-looking survey. So when we did the survey before budget, we saw some interesting stats. So I think people are clearer now on what the budget is saying. So overall, I would say it's fairly positive in terms of the intentions.
And so what is the big difference then, when you chat to the bosses at these businesses, between now and a year ago? So we might have seen potentially see a turn in the corner, and we'll see how the months play out. But why still so far behind a year ago?
I think when you look at the pending budget and the nervousness around some of the cost hikes, there was a great deal of uncertainty within businesses. Some of that uncertainty is still continuing. For example, with the Employment Rights Bill, we know that one of the policies is just about to be confirmed, but there is still a level of uncertainty. And what we're also seeing is the impact of the announcement of further cost increases next year with the minimum wage. Mm. This is having an impact on the hospitality sector, because businesses just can't afford to hire that extra labour, particularly at this time of year. So still a lot of uncertainty.
Petra, thank you. Petra Tagg there, Director at the Recruiters Manpower.
Sean, thank you. 23 minutes past seven. A revolutionary gene therapy has successfully treated patients with aggressive and previously incurable blood cancers. It was developed by scientists at Great Ormond Street Hospital and University College London. Alyssa Tapley was the first person in the world to have the therapy 3 years ago. She is now 16 and cancer-free, and joins us now on the line with mum Kiona as well, and her Labrador, Holly, too. Good morning to you all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Alyssa, first of all, take us back, if you would, to when you were first diagnosed. It was T-cell leukemia, wasn't it? So May 2021. What did they tell you then?
So when I was first diagnosed, I was actually sedated. So I knew later than everyone else, kind of. Which, you know, when I first found out, I don't think I really processed it. It's not really a thing that you think that you accept within like a day or two of finding out the news.
I can understand that. People will definitely understand that. But a shock nonetheless, as it sunk in that you had something that was very, very serious, and you knew that.
Yeah. It was really hard. I think, you know, when I started not being able to go home as much and I started spending a lot more time in hospital, it definitely got a lot harder than, you know.
And you must have felt awful too, because one of the symptoms, well, is sort of overall tiredness. You would have felt increasingly exhausted.
One of the I was really tired before I was diagnosed as well.
Yeah.
So it was one of the main symptoms of how it got so bad. But I think maybe the worst one was just the sickness, because I would just be sick all the time. And it got to a point where I couldn't even eat or anything or drink anything, because I would just throw it right back up.
Okay. So they say to you, look, we've got this gene therapy trial. We're going to put you on it. You can be the first person. And you did it. How soon did you realise that it was working, Alyssa?
So I was in Great Ormond Street Hospital for 4 months, and I think everything seems like it seems so long ago, but it wasn't. I was in Great Ormond Street Hospital for 4 months, and I think we found out 3.5 months in that I was cancer-free, and I just remember it. I can't compare that level of happiness to anything that I have ever felt. Like, the amount of emotion and just going from a place where you thought that you were never going to grow up and you were never going to have a future to live, to somewhere where there are endless opportunities and there's so many possibilities, and just being able to have the knowledge that you're going to be able to see your brother again and see your friends and the rest of your family. It's...
And I can see your mum, Kiona, she's in the same studio as you, looking on as you say those things. It must have been that same thing for you, Kiona, at that moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think when she first was diagnosed, we thought, oh, she's going to take the normal route and, you know, she's going to have chemo and it's going to be really tough, but we're sort of going to get through it. And then when we found out all the other treatment wasn't working and we actually got to the point where they were talking, you know, they said, we're not looking to cure the leukemia now, we're just looking to keep her comfortable. And you go from a place where you've got absolutely no hope whatsoever. And although it was in Great Ormond Street and we knew she was taking part in this trial, you've had such negative news. Part of you really wants to make it work, but then also a part of you thinks, you know, if it works, it's a miracle. And at that point, it's quite difficult to sort of believe in miracles after everything you've been through. And when they first told us, it was... you just couldn't quite believe it. You were just waiting for them to turn around and say, no, actually, you know, we've got it wrong, or it's not, because it just completely sort of came out of the blue. It was such a long shot that it was going to work, that when it actually did, yeah, it's just unbelievable. It's...
And part of the celebration, because we do need to get to Holly, because I can see I can see you inside the studio,
oh,
and I can
see,
goodness, the occasional wagging tail. But Alyssa, you wanted a dog, didn't you, basically all the way through, but you couldn't because you're immunosuppressed. I mean, Holly is the perfect example of everything that's gone right for you now, I guess.
Definitely. So when we first got Holly, it was after my first failed bone marrow transplant. Well, my first bone marrow transplant. And, you know, it was at this point where it was like, I had wanted a dog for so long. And, you know, we had even like brought all the staff in the hospital together to try and persuade my mum and dad to get me a dog. So when it didn't work, it was one of the things where it was like, this is what Alyssa has wanted for so long, so we need to get her a dog, which is how we ended up with Holly. But then after the trial and I came back home and I was cured, she definitely helped with my physiotherapy.
Yes, I can imagine so. Well, it's wonderful to see you all. Thank you so much for coming in. Alyssa, Kiona, Mum, and Holly as well, if Holly is conscious of me talking to her, which I don't think she is. There we go. No, she's gone to sleep. Yeah, probably quite a good option for her. Thanks all. And that brings us to time for the sport at 29 minutes past seven. And Cathy is back.
Thank you very much. We'll start with a couple of football headlines. The Liverpool manager Arne Slot says he is not weak after the Liverpool forward Mo Salah had said he feels he's been thrown under the bus after being dropped to the bench for Liverpool's last three games. Comments that Slot said surprised him, and he has now left Salah out of the Liverpool squad for tonight's Champions League match at Inter Milan. Chelsea are away at Atalanta and Tottenham host Slavia Prague. And last night, Manchester United beat Wolves 4-1 in the Premier League. United move up to sixth place. Now, you may have heard the childhood karting coach of the new Formula One world champion, Lando Norris, on this programme yesterday, discussing how sibling rivalry helped shape Norris's career. Here's a reminder of what Rob Dodd said.
He had an older brother, so they're both racing at the same time. So there was a bit of a sibling rivalry, which I think really pushed Lando on at an early age. He had somebody to chase every time he went testing, etc. He was there racing his brother. So when it actually came to going on the big stage at the age of 8 years old, he was already competitive.
Well, to discuss some of the psychology behind this, we have the author of Mind Games and an Olympic rowing silver medalist, Annie Vernon, in the studio. Morning, Annie.
Morning, Cathy.
Lando Norris, Andy Murray, Usain Bolt, Serena Williams, all second children. Why does it make such a difference to the sports mentality?
Well, speaking as a second sibling myself, I've got an older brother and a younger brother. I think the research behind the second sibling and also the twin theory that these are the children that succeed in elite sport, it's really about competing against someone else. So from the age of of zero. You've always been competing against someone who's bigger than you, stronger than you, more physically able than you. So you will always lose these races and these battles from the second that you're born. And so it's not that the older sibling doesn't like sport or doesn't excel in it, but it's the idea of competing and being measured. So throughout your entire life, you've been seeking out opportunities to be measured because that's what you're comfortable with, because that's what you've been doing since you were born.
But being measured and presumably being used to failure, which must make a difference.
Precisely. You're always going to be beaten by this big sibling and who's probably been turning around and laughing in your face as they beat you your whole life. So exactly. It's not being very good at something, but constantly striving for this standard that's just out of reach. You can never quite get there, but you can always strive to try and hit it. And that trains your brain to seek out those opportunities to be measured, those opportunities to test yourself. And certainly I look at my older brother, he loves sports. But I'm the one who always look for those opportunities to do structured, competitive sport. And the evidence suggests that's why it's the second sibling that goes on to succeed.
And you mentioned twins. How does it work with twins?
Well, I was lucky enough to be part of the British rowing team in the London 2012 Olympics. And we had 17 women on that team who qualified to race, of which four were twins, you know, were one half of twins, which is, you know, incredibly high relative to the population. But it's the same as the great rivalries in sport. You know, people talk about Nadal, Federer, Messi, Ronaldo. Well, imagine if your greatest rival is sat in the pram next to you from the day you arrive home from hospital. It's the same thing. You know, you've always got somebody who is potentially genetically your equal, and they are there to push you, to compete against you. And that's why often the twins also end up in competitive sport.
And just briefly, there's a very interesting statistic about junior champions and then what happens to them as they get older. What's that?
Yeah, so there's a lot of research that suggests that the best junior athletes in the world do not become the best senior athletes in the world for exactly the same reason that it's the second sibling that often then rises to the top in competitive sport. And I've seen a study that suggests that only 7% of the best teenagers in the world, you know, such that you can judge that, then go on to be the best senior athletes in the world. And it's the same thing. It's failure, it's setbacks, it's developing resilience, it's being told you're not good enough. That is self-selecting. So the people that finally make it through, you know, they're the really gritty ones. They're the ones who are happy with setbacks and are ready to keep fighting.
Like Lando Norris, the Formula One world champion. Thank you very much, Annie Vernon.
Cathy, thank you.
On BBC Sounds. Ensure all is calm this Christmas with a special festive sleeping forecast.
On Christmas Eve, old Scrooge sat busy in his counting house.
Wrap yourself in timeless tunes with my Christmas crooners mix. Classics from Bing Crosby to Michael Bublé.
Have a holly jolly Christmas.
And step back with soothing seasonal tracks on the Mindful Mix.
Get all kinds of Christmassy.
Just search Christmas music on BBC Sounds.
To the weather, a wet and windy start across the UK today. Rain continuing to move north. It's going to leave cloudy skies and showers in the afternoon. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Justin Webb. It is just coming up to 25 to 8. Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
The head of a national review into NHS maternity care in England says she's been shocked by what she describes as the repeated experiences of trauma endured by women and families. In an interim report, Baroness Amos says they continue to be let down by a lack of basic care and empathy, despite hundreds of recommendations made after inquiries into maternity services in the past decade. Australia's new law banning young teenagers from some of their favourite social media platforms comes into force today. Companies that fail to take reasonable steps to prevent under-16s from opening accounts could face fines of up to £25 million. A revolutionary gene therapy has successfully treated patients with aggressive and previously incurable blood cancers. The treatment, developed by scientists at Great Ormond Street Hospital and University College London, edits the DNA of white blood cells into what's being called a living drug. Cambodia and Thailand say they've launched fresh strikes against each other as their long-running border dispute again flares into deadly conflict. Thailand says three of its soldiers have been killed. Cambodia says two more civilians have been killed in overnight shelling, bringing the total deaths on its side to seven. A number of weather warnings have come into force in parts of Wales, Scotland and southwest England as Storm Bram sweeps across the UK. The Met Office says the storm could lead to damage to homes and buildings, flooding, power cuts and significant travel disruption. A report out today is expected to say that rapidly designed COVID support programmes created a golden opportunity for fraudsters, contributing to taxpayer losses of almost £11 billion. The furlough scheme and Eat Out to Help Out are included in the review. The winner of this year's prestigious Turner Art Prize will be announced tonight at a ceremony in Bradford, the UK's City of Culture. Four artists have been nominated for the award and a £25,000 prize.
Thank you for that. 24 minutes to eight. The conflict in Northern Ireland has been over for years, but the horrors inflicted on people there by the IRA and by loyalist paramilitaries still cause understandable hurt and a sense of grievance of matters not yet put to rest. Today, an effort is being made to put some of it to rest with the publication of the final report of Operation Canova, which was established back in 2016 to look at the activities, among other things, of an informer given the name of Steak Knife, who was in the IRA squad that tortured and killed suspected informers. John Ware, the investigative reporter, formerly of course of Panorama, covered Northern Ireland for his whole career. In 2017, his Panorama documentary, The Spy in the IRA, looked into the investigation, and John is on the line now. Morning to you.
Morning.
What are we learning today that we didn't know before, if anything?
I think we're going to learn how he was recruited. We're going to learn a little more about the scale of his criminality. We're going to learn about the difficulties of prosecuting cases this far out from the conflict itself. And I think we're also going to learn, rather frustratingly for the families involved anyway, and certainly for the Chief Constable and his colleague, Cyrian Livingston, who's taken over Canova, as they would see it anyway, the sort of dogmatic application of the Cabinet Office Protocol known as Neither Confirm Nor Deny. So what that boils down to is that even though everybody knows that Mr. Scappaticci is the agent known as Steak Knife, the Security Service and government departments will not, even today, allow the Canova report to identify Scappaticci as Steak Knife.
And just set out why that matters so much to the families, given that we're all talking about this man. He's dead. It's perfectly okay to talk about him. There's no libel issue or anything. But why is it that the fact of his name not being in the report matters so much to them?
Well, first of all, the families themselves have been getting discreet family reports, and the language in those reports has sometimes been extraordinarily tortuous. So you really have to read the reports several times to work out, you know, who we're talking about, whether we're talking about the agent or the suspect, because sometimes it's both. The second thing I think is there's a question of trust. Of course, you're right that There is no dispute that Mr. Scappaticci was the agent known as Steak Knife. But to a lot of people here, and you'll appreciate this, Justin, it doesn't take a lot to get a conspiracy theory on fire here. It's a question of trust. If you can't even acknowledge the identity of Mr. Scappaticci, of Steak Knife, then what else are you hiding? And more importantly, there are a vast number of unsolved killings from the legacy. I'm not sure people understand that on your side. I'm in Belfast at the moment, on your side of the Irish Sea. There are something like 1,200 unresolved killings. Now, we don't know how many of those involve the state, but in terms of agents, but a significant number, minority maybe, and the position, the way that NCND is now applied is that even in inquests and civil proceedings and the like, the government simply close up shop whenever there is the prospect of an agent being named, not by name, just the mere fact of the agent's presence in the killing.
And of course, it's not just Scabatici, is it? Because we've got this, it's a sort of subset, isn't it, of the report, this Operation Denton, which has looked at loyalist paramilitaries and the suggestion that there were members, serving members of the UDR, the Ulster Defence Regiment, and indeed police people as well, who were either involved or actually even members of this gang.
Yes, gang is probably putting a bit high. It became known as the Glenam Gang. It was more a sort of an association of, like-minded protagonists. But it did involve, as far as the military was concerned, they were almost exclusively reserve soldiers in the UDR, and there were some police officers as well. That, as I understand it, has been a review rather than criminal investigation. The Canova investigation into Stake Knife was a criminal investigation.
Right, so that then leads, I suppose, to the final thought, which is, as a result of all of this, and Canova's been going, hasn't it, since 2016, if we've got to the final moment, and we're not going to have the name of Scabatici, though everyone knows that name, what now?
Well, that's a very good question. The MI5 has the whip hand in this. I mean, they dictate, they influence ministers, and ministers, generally speaking, take their cue from the service about what constitutes a threat to national security. And the argument, I think it's important to people understand that the government's case here, they see naming Scabatici as Stake Knife as a sort of slippery slope, that it will impact on the recruitment and the retention of agents in future. And so it has to be applied, consistently. Now, we have the chief constable of the PSNI here and the former head of Police Scotland. I mean, these are not girl guides. These guys have been at the hard end of policing impacting on national security. In John Boucher's case, a very significant number of cases he handled over Al-Qaeda and Islamic State. So, I mean, you know, they know all about, they would say, they more than anybody understand what is and isn't a threat to national security. They simply don't accept that acknowledging at inquest and in civil proceedings now that an agent, without naming the agent, obviously, was involved in severe criminality is a risk, is a threat to national security. MI5 take a completely different view, and it's an irreconcilable position at the moment.
John Ware, thank you.
It's 16 minutes to 8. A Truth Social post from Donald Trump. I have just approved tiny cars to be built in the United States. Amazing, he says. Start building them now. Enjoy. It was at a meeting in the Oval Office with US automakers on Wednesday that President Trump said he noticed these little cars on his recent trip to Japan.
If you go to Japan, where I just left, and if you go to South Korea and Malaysia and other countries, they have a very small car, sort of like the Beetle used to be with the Volkswagen. They're very small. They're really cute. And I said, how would that do in this country? And everyone seems to think good, but you're not allowed to build them. And I've authorized the secretary to immediately approve the production of those cars. So you'll be able to buy the, they really are, they're actually, some of them are really beautiful, actually.
Well, Vicky Parrott is the editor of electrifying.com, motoring journalist, road tester. You've been in one of these cars, Vicky. Morning.
I have, yes. No, I have driven a K car. They're fantastic fun. Yeah, they're great things.
When we say tiny, how tiny are we? Because American cars are really big. So how tiny are we talking?
So K cars are, they've been for a long time in Japan. So they're urban cars and they're legislated. They have to be 3.4 metres long maximum. So that's smaller than even really kind of the smallest cars that you get in the UK. So 3.4 metres long, and they have to be a maximum of 660 cc's as well. So, yeah, so they are very small cars.
OK, and what are the benefits? You could probably park them more easily, I would imagine, but environmental benefits, cost benefits, presumably?
Yeah, all of that. I mean, obviously, in Japan, in Tokyo, then space is very much at a premium. And so the K car exists. There's tax benefits to it. There's efficiency benefits to it. and they offer the maximum amount of space and efficiency you can get in a small car, and that's always been the idea of them. So they're clever little things, and they are good fun.
Practically speaking, if you were in one of these tiny cars and you were on a big US highway surrounded by massive multi-axle trucks and, you know, great big, can you have cars that are so wildly different working together in the same environment? Will everybody be safe?
Yeah, so this is one of the problems with the idea of the K car in America. And I think that Trump's comments are very interesting, because there is a lot of talk in America following that actually the safety regulations with K cars, as they are in Japan and the equivalent that you do get in South Korea and this kind of thing, are a problem. Obviously, there's very stringent safety regulations in America and in Europe for producing cars. And K cars, they wouldn't meet those regulations, so you would need to modify them in some way. I think it's a very interesting concept, and I think the point here is to think that, you know, the idea of a K car having a very small, very efficient, very useful little car, they are limited, but they're a really good tool for a certain usage. And cars, as with many things, you can have the right tool for the right job. So a K car type car isn't going to be right for everybody, but it can be a fantastic second car in a household. It can be perfect for somebody who spends a lot of their time in urban surroundings in the city. If you do a lot of journeys on the motorway, something like that probably isn't going to suit you. But like I said, the right tool for the right job. And K cars are really cool, the idea of them. But yes, they would need modifications for certainly for America and for Europe as well.
Interesting. Vicky Parrott from electrifying.com. Thank you.
13 minutes to 8. Time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning, Vishwapani, a member of the Triratna Buddhist Order.
Good morning. There's no more vexed issue in politics at present than the status of asylum seekers. It's a complex debate that understandably focuses on the difficulty of absorbing more people and the struggles of those who are already here. But for now, I want to focus on just one aspect because I think it can get lost. We're talking about people, many, though by no means all of whom, are eventually recognised as genuine victims of persecution. Take Connie. She fled Congo, where soldiers in one of the warring factions had raped and tortured her. She came to the UK, where she received treatment for trauma, and I met Connie because my father and stepmother befriended her. Over time, they helped her build a new life. Behind the statistics are many more people like Connie, and their presence in our society confronts us with an issue that's at the heart of Buddhist practice. How do we respond when we encounter suffering? A political response is one thing, but there's also a spiritual dimension. Buddhism teaches that when we encounter suffering with an open and balanced mind, the natural response is compassion. Compassion differs from pity, which includes a sense of being superior to another person, and from hatred, which rejects them entirely. For Buddhists, compassion begins with a willingness to recognize the reality of others' suffering, and it brings an impulse to help them. My father responded to Connie because of his own experience. He came to Britain in 1939 on a Kinder transport train from Berlin. Britain's rightly proud of the scheme that rescued 10,000 Jewish children from the Nazis, but it's less often mentioned that it came very late and on the condition that private groups took financial responsibility for them. Only unaccompanied children were allowed to come, and adults remained behind, where most were killed, like my grandfather and many others in my family. My father responded to that history with determination to be compassionate. And that, in turn, prompted my own faith in the Buddhist insight that what we dwell on becomes the inclination of our minds. Compassion moulds us, and so does anger. Whatever immigration policy we favour, I think the role of wisdom traditions like Buddhism is to remind us of the cost to ourselves and to society as a whole of closing ourselves to others' suffering.
That was Thought for the Day with Vishwapani, a member of the Triratna Buddhist Order. It is 10 to 8.
The Australians have done it. They have banned social media for the under 16s. Well, not completely, but they are giving it a go. The ban starts today, and the rest of the world, worried about what we have been doing to our kids, watches and waits to see what will come of it. Dr. Anne Webster is an Australian MP for the Opposition National Party and a supporter of the ban.
In an ideal world, children would be allowed to be children. The damage that is being done, as we hear research piece after research piece, for young people who find themselves bullied online, who are victims of those who prey on them as youngsters, just has to be managed. And the fact is we've lost too many lives.
How confident are you it'll work?
I don't have a huge amount of confidence at this point in time. I hope it will work. I really do. And I know this is very divided. There are some parents who think that their children should be able to do whatever. But the reality is that we have laws in place, both in Britain, certainly in Australia, that prohibit children from engaging in gambling or pornography. Like, we try and protect them.
The issue, I suppose, for those like you who support this legislation is potentially there are too many loopholes, aren't there? And you think of some of the gaming sites, Roblox is one of them, that are still going to exist and that children can still be on.
Yeah, absolutely. I believe if I read the reports that Roblox are looking at separating out through age verification of some means or other to separate so younger kids can not be prey to those who are older. But I think that actually raises the question about age verification. How do you verify someone's age? It's still not at a point where you had confidence of 5 years older or 5 years younger. That's a very big window. Mm. So one of my own staff has a 15-year-old son, and he was told to get off the social media platform and asked to reapply. He reapplied. The age verification system within that particular platform deemed that he was 20. I mean, that's a problem.
How confident are you that they get this, that they are willing to do what they're being told they have to do in Australia?
I think a $50 million fine is pretty serious. I think the platforms will take that seriously. But, you know, we go back to the fact that we're no longer simply managing national issues. We have global players that play in our space who provide all kinds of services to Australians as they do to Britons. There is going to be a lot of work to ensure that this does function, that it achieves what it sets out to achieve. I, you know, have my doubts about the current government being able to enforce and, frankly, to implement. But we, in principle, agree with the ban. We, in principle, agree that this is better than doing nothing to protect our children.
Dr. Anne Webster, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
And just a word about Roblox, because we got in touch with them. They have got back in touch with us and confirmed, actually, that those restrictions that she was talking about there, restrictions designed to limit communication between adults and minors, have been put in place recently. They say they're not really impacted by all of this because they are principally a gaming platform. Let us talk to Richard Waterworth, who's listening to that, who's the former general manager for TikTok in the UK and Europe. Morning to you.
Good morning.
Do you think it'll work?
Well, I'd love to see positive effects and you know, you've got to support the intent of this, but unfortunately my professional experience tells me that this is kind of a magical thinking solution. Everybody who talks about it seems to acknowledge that it's not going to work as intended, that there are lots of loopholes. And I think, you know, that sounds like, okay, it's an abstract thing. But what that actually means in reality is that a lot of kids are going to lie about their age. They're not going to have access to the safety tools that platforms have built. They're not going to be able to link their account to their parents' account. They're not going to get the right, you know, recommended feed of content. So I think it's going to have a lot of unintended consequences. And unfortunately, I don't think that's necessarily a win for safety.
Is one of the ways of dealing with that, though, to improve the age verification? Because we talked about this quite a lot in the programme, actually over years now, and people saying we are much better, companies can be much better if they want to be at age verification. Is that a fair point to make, do you think?
I think age verification technology has improved over time, but you know, age verification comes with its own, again, unintended consequences. You have to collect data, biometric data, in order to do that. And so that's, you know, that's a challenge and, you know, not something that, a lot of people would want, you know, companies holding their biometric data. So, you know, having to do that creates a lot of other issues. So it's not a kind of, it's not a silver bullet, unfortunately.
You're not speaking for the industry this morning and you're out of it. You're not doing that for TikTok anymore. But give us a kind of insight into what is going on behind the scenes when people talk about these things now within the industry. Is there, I wonder if one of the impacts of what the Australians are trying to do, at least, is that it leads to a conversation in the industry where they say to themselves, you know, the bottom line isn't enough in this. We can't just be commercially involved. We've got to have a wider social involvement, and we've got to do it for real.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, these companies over quite a number of years now have built up really large teams focusing on user safety, and child safety is a huge part of that. They've built tools, built technology, built systems to support that, and they've engaged with different regulations around the world. You know, in Europe and the UK, we have a different set of regulations that assesses the robustness of those safety systems. So, you know, these companies are packed with parents. You know, I'm a parent, are packed with parents who really understand the issues and really care about the issues. So, these are complex, difficult issues. And actually, in these companies, you've got some of the organizations in the world that have spent the most time thinking about these issues, engaging with civil society, engaging with educators, you know, to understand the issues and try and build tools and systems to address them. So that's kind of what's going on.
Let us leave it there. Richard Waterworth, former general manager for TikTok in the UK and Europe. Thank you.
It's 8:03. This Friday night, award-winning satire returns to Radio 4.
I heard this is going to be a great party. Very, very merry. The merriest one ever.
Dead ringers at Christmas.
As Chancellor, I am proud to say for this year's party, I am lifting the 2-mince-pie buffet cap.
I want to hear all your Christmas plans in detail, babes.
I hope to spend that evening sitting at home, crocheting a Christmas jumper from discarded cat hair.
I've brought mistletoe and I'm prepared to use it. Now, where's the chicken party bucket?
Dead Ringers on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Friday nights, 6:30 comedy.
A very happy Christmas.
To the weather, Helen Willits.
Justin, thanks. Storm Bram today will cause widespread disruption. We've just had an update as well for amber warnings. So just to fill you in on those, because it does mean there's a potential danger to life. The amber warnings are for South Wales and South West England for the rain, up to 75, even 100 millimetres throughout the rest of today. Already we've seen in excess of 50 in some parts here. The rain heaviest now across Scotland, the far north of Northern Ireland, northern and eastern England, but bursts then of heavy rain following on behind, and perhaps some brightness. But the winds are escalating. So there are quite widespread wind warnings out today. It's going to be very windy in many parts of Western England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. Gusts of 60, 70 miles an hour. But there are 2 amber warnings out now. One for Scotland, kicking in at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Gusts of wind in excess of 80 miles an hour, possibly 90 miles an hour here. So gales or severe gale force winds battering the UK. Now an amber Met Office warning has been issued for wind in Northern Ireland. And gusts here expected to locally reach 80 miles an hour. So we are really going to see this powerful storm bearing down on us through today, largely disrupted, but it's mild at least.
Thank you, Helen. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Anna Foster.
It's 8:00 on Tuesday, the 9th of December. The headlines this morning: the chair of a review into maternity care in England says she is shocked at what she has found, and nothing prepared her for the scale of unacceptable treatment. We'll hear from Baroness Valerie Amos just after the news at 8:10. A social media ban for under-16s is coming into force in Australia. And patients with previously incurable blood cancers have been successfully treated with a revolutionary gene therapy developed in the UK.
Also on the programme this morning, Great British Rail has a new look this morning, but what practical improvements might we see on our trains? The Transport Secretary, Heidi Alexander, is with us at 8:20. People trying to access their own care records are being let down. That's according to the Information Commissioner. So what more can be done to improve access to our personal data? And what does it feel like to uncover that information about yourself? We'll discuss it at 8:30. And...
when in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state, and trouble death heaven with my bootless cries, and look upon myself and curse my fate.
Dame Judi Dench, who turns 91 today, might be able to recite endless Shakespeare from memory, but she says she struggles to remember what she's doing tomorrow. So how do our brains work out what to remember? Before that, the BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
The head of a national review into NHS maternity care in England says she's been shocked by what she called the constant experiences of trauma that women and families have gone through across the country. In a report giving her initial findings, Baroness Amos says nothing prepared her for the scale of unacceptable treatment. She says families continue to be let down by a lack of basic care and empathy, despite hundreds of recommendations made after inquiries into maternity services in the past decade. Here's our social affairs correspondent, Michael Buchanan.
Baroness Amos was asked by the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, to chair a review looking at why so many families receive poor maternity care in England. She said consistent themes have already emerged, women being ignored and feeling blame for the deaths of their babies, while NHS organisations are viewed as marking their own homework when things go wrong. Class and colour matter too, with poor and black women often receiving worse care. Maternity staff also reported receiving death threats while working in poorly performing units. Previous inquiries, said Baroness Amos, had led to almost 750 recommendations for improving maternity care, yet still the harm continues. Wes Streeting has promised to implement the review's own recommendations when they're published in the spring.
A new law comes into force in Australia later today, banning young teenagers from some of their favourite social media platforms, including Snapchat, TikTok and Instagram. It's being touted as world-first legislation, and under the new rules, if companies fail to take reasonable steps to prevent under-16s from opening accounts, they could be fined up to £25 million. Our Australia correspondent Katie Watson reports from Sydney.
In Australia, Tuesday is almost over, supposedly the last day of digital freedom for the country's young teens. The new rules mean no more Snapchat or TikTok videos or liking of photos. Some of the most popular social media platforms will be off limits for under-16s. People here are calling it a ban. The government prefers to use the word delay, giving youngsters more time to grow up before being let loose on social media. Whatever the term, the majority of teens are not happy about it. Plenty of parents, on the other hand, see this as a show of support by the government, standing up to the big US tech companies who've been criticised for not doing enough in recent years to prevent online harm. Ministers say it's a treatment plan, not a cure. The rollout might be messy. It's certainly a novel experiment. The world will be watching to see if it works.
A revolutionary gene therapy has successfully treated patients with aggressive and previously incurable blood cancers. It involves editing the DNA of white blood cells to turn them into what's being called a living drug. The treatment has been developed by scientists at Great Ormond Street Hospital and University College London. More details from our medical editor, Fergus Walsh.
9 children and 2 adults with an aggressive form of leukemia have been treated with the pioneering gene therapy technique called base editing. This involved taking donor white blood cells and making precise changes to single bases, the building blocks of genetic code, among the billions in their DNA. The donor cells were modified so they would not attack the patient's body, but would target cancer cells. The results published in the New England Journal of Medicine show that 64% of the patients remain disease-free.
16-year-old Alyssa Tapley was the first patient to be treated and is now cancer-free. She told us she felt incredibly happy when it was confirmed that the treatment had worked.
Going from a place where you thought that you were never going to grow up and you were never going to have a future to live to somewhere where there are endless opportunities and there's so many possibilities, and just being able to have the knowledge that you're going to be able to see your brother again and see your friends and the rest of your family.
A number of weather warnings have come into force in parts of Wales, Scotland and southwest England as Storm Bram sweeps across the UK. The Met Office says the storm could lead to damage to homes and buildings, flooding, power cuts and significant travel disruption. A police review into the Army's top spy in the IRA, known as Steak Knife, is to publish its final report. The findings are likely to include new information on how he was recruited. Detectives from the investigation called Operation Canova have also been examining the extent to which the security forces colluded with a loyalist paramilitary group in the 1970s. Here's our Ireland correspondent Chris Page.
The spy with the codename Steak Knife was widely believed to have been Freddy Scapaticci from West Belfast. He was in the IRA's internal security squad, which tortured and killed Irish Republicans who were suspected of being informants for the security forces. But Scapaticci himself was working as an agent for the British Army. He died in hiding in England 2 years ago. Operation Canova's interim report last year said the spy probably cost more lives than he saved. The final review, which will be published today, will also include the findings of the team's investigation into a group of loyalists who were based at a farm near the village of Glen Ann in County Armagh. They were suspected of carrying out 120 murders. Police officers and soldiers were alleged to have been members of the unit known as the Glen Ann Gang.
A report out today is expected to say that rapidly designed COVID support programmes created a golden opportunity for fraudsters, contributing to taxpayer losses of almost £11 billion. The COVID Counter-Fraud Commissioner, Tom Hayhoe, was appointed a year ago to try to recover the money lost through schemes and underperforming contracts. Here's our business correspondent, Theo Leggett.
During the pandemic, as the country went into lockdown, the then Conservative government implemented a wide range of policies aimed at protecting businesses and safeguarding jobs. They included the furlough scheme, the self-employment income support scheme, and several loan programmes. Later, there were measures to help the economy recover, such as Eat Out to Help Out. While the Treasury's actions at the time have been widely credited with helping to mitigate the economic fallout from the pandemic, today's report is expected to say that rushed implementation and a lack of controls contributed to losses from fraud and error of £10.9 billion. The Commissioner has previously highlighted how pandemic-era contracts for protective equipment cost taxpayers £1.4 billion, which was spent on unusable gowns, masks and gloves. So far, only about £400 million has been recovered.
A BBC investigation has found that an Anglican bishop accused of bullying is facing fresh complaints of alleged misconduct. Bishop Anne Dyer, Scotland's first female bishop, was temporarily suspended while the Scottish Episcopal Church investigated earlier allegations, which she denies. She says the new complaints are totally without merit. Steve Swan reports.
Anne Dyer made history when she became the Bishop of Aberdeen and Orkney in 2018, but her time at the helm has been controversial. In 2021, a report commissioned by the church concluded she should resign over concerns about her leadership style. She didn't, and said the report was flawed. Last year, a senior lawyer ruled against a church tribunal into claims she'd bullied three women, despite finding a realistic prospect of conviction. Fallon 4 Investigates has learned Bishop Dyer returned to work last November without a risk assessment, and that since then at least six fresh complaints of misconduct have been made against her. Bishop Dyer says the complaints are frivolous and totally without merit. The Scottish Episcopal Church says it acknowledges deep wounds, but has called for reconciliation.
The winner of this year's prestigious Turner Art Prize will be announced tonight at a ceremony in Bradford. One artist will walk away with the £25,000 prize, following in the footsteps of Damien Hirst, Rachel Whiteread and Steve McQueen. Here's our culture editor, Katie Razzell.
For the first time, the Turner is in Bradford, this year's UK City of Culture and the birthplace of David Hockney. This year, 28-year-old Rini Matic is the second youngest nominee ever. The Peterborough-born artist works mainly in photography to explore British culture. The Canadian-Korean artist Zadie Char's work is a gold mirror-floored installation of shamanic bells, otherworldly paintings and hanging conch shells. Iraqi-born Mohammed Sami's vast paintings are about memory and conflict, depicting the violence of war. And Naina Kalu makes large swirling drawings and hanging sculptures from VHS tape, rope and fabric. With limited verbal communication, she's the first solo artist with a learning disability ever to be nominated. And a win for her would make history.
Katie Razzle reporting. Thank you, Jane. It's 10 minutes past eight. The first reflections from a nationwide investigation into maternity services in England have been published this morning, with its chair, Baroness Amos, saying the scale of unacceptable care across the country was extremely concerning. She also called it much worse than she anticipated. We'll speak to her in just a moment. The first proper findings from the review won't be published until early next year, with recommendations then to follow. But the stories so far are stark and upsetting. They show a culture of families not being listened to, and of black women and women from poorer backgrounds experiencing that even more acutely. This despite there having been various reviews into maternity care over the last decade or so, which produced nearly 750 recommendations about how to make things better and safer. Emily Barley's daughter Beatrice died in 2022 after staff mistakenly checked Emily's heart instead of baby Beatrice's. Emily also co-founded the Maternity Safety Alliance. She's been telling me her story.
My daughter Beatrice died during labour at full term. She was a healthy baby and she died because of really basic failings in care and also cruelty by staff. Instead of monitoring her properly, they were shrugging their shoulders. Instead of listening to me when I was raising concerns and then when I was begging for help, they were rolling their eyes. And then instead of raising the alarm near the end, the doctor was laughing and she was laughing at me. And that was while Beatrice was dying. So Beatrice now, she should be 3.5 years old and excited for Christmas. But instead she died. And she died in part because I wasn't listened to. I knew it was wrong and I wasn't listened to. It's the same story for hundreds of families every year. And now that's the story with this rapid review. We're still not being listened to and babies will continue to die because of that.
Barnsley Hospital, where you had Beatrice, they apologised for what happened. But the reason that you are still talking about this is that you don't want other parents to go through what you went through. What are your thoughts on the review, which is still in progress at the moment?
The report that's come out today, it beggars belief, to be honest. It's taken all this time to come up with a list of issues that any decently informed member of the public could have written up 6 months ago. It's superficial, there's no depth or detail. And what's really scary is that this is now planned to supersede the recommendations and actions from investigations that actually were robust and thorough. And it just shouldn't be happening. And I think from today, it's really clear that Baroness Amos doesn't get it. She's describing poor experiences and poor care. That word poor comes up time and again in this report. She's talking about our children who were killed and other children who were horrifically injured with life-changing, really serious brain injuries. And this kind of language is just minimising what's happening. And meanwhile, this report, it sort of majors on staff experiences, which are, you know, awful, but they're not as awful as your child being killed. And it's also really concerning to me that in this report today, Baroness Amos says she doesn't understand how change is so slow. She's just not been listening. We've explained this. But ultimately, I think my message today is that this is not on Baroness Amos entirely. This is Wes Streeting's area of responsibility. Where is he? He knows that this is wrong. And he's not listening to us. He won't meet with us anymore. He seems really to be in hiding and is throwing this all of his responsibility for maternity into a rapid review that he knows is wrong and won't work.
Well, Baroness Amos is with us and listening to that. Baroness Amos, good morning. I know that these are these are your initial thoughts and reflections ahead of your first findings, which will come early next year. But I'd like to give you the chance to respond directly. You were listening to what Emily had to say there. What is your response to her?
Well, first of all, my condolences to Emily for the loss of Beatrice. I have listened to many families who have reflected similar experiences to that Emily has just described. And it's a terrible situation for those families. And what I'd like to say to Emily is that, Emily, these are not my findings. These are not my recommendations. I am just reflecting back what I have heard in the 3 months since we started our work. And I'm immensely grateful to the families. There are over 170 family members that I have spoken to now who have talked to me, talked to members of the team, been prepared to share some extremely traumatic and difficult experiences. Because what we are seeking to do is to come up with a set of national recommendations. Some of our families have been very, very clear to me. They feel very strongly that the only thing that will make a difference is the statutory public inquiry, that it's the only thing that will give them the accountability and justice that they are seeking. We are not that, but I do hope that we will be able to come up with some systemic changes that will mean that what we are continuing to see up and down the country will stop.
You've said that in your initial thoughts and reflections that what you've found has been much worse than you anticipated and that the scale is extremely concerning. Now things are worse than even you thought they were. Do you think you have sufficient power? Should there be a statutory public inquiry? Because you also highlight the more than 700 recommendations on maternity and neonatal care that have been made in the last decade that haven't been brought in. You talk there about pressing again for some of those to be implemented. Do you feel that you have the power that you need to make a change here?
So a decision on a statutory public inquiry is not for me to make.
Would it be useful, do you think, though? I realise it's not your decision, but I'm interested in whether you wish you had that extra level of power.
I agreed to chair this independent investigation on the basis of a set of terms of reference which are seeking urgent systemic change. A statutory public inquiry is something which the Secretary of State and others in government will consider. And I think the Secretary of State has said that his mind remains open on this. My focus is, given that these harms continue to be done, given that babies continue to die, given that this is happening across the country, and that is one of the things that has surprised me, which is that some of the consistency that we are seeing across different parts of the country. So are there things that we should be doing to standardise the level of care across different trusts? Yes, there are guidelines, but do we need more than that? And the thing that is different about this investigation is that the Secretary of State has committed to setting up a task force that he will chair with experts on it, family informed, that will put in place an implementation plan, an action plan to make sure the changes happen. And there are some of the recommendations from previously that have been implemented, but we also need to know which those are and what impact they've had and how sustainable have they been. I am really concerned that change sometimes happens, and then because leadership changes or because other things change in the environment in which a trust is working, that they make progress and then fall back. So why? We need to understand those systemic things.
So do you feel that you entered into this with a cast iron commitment from the Health Secretary that what you eventually find and the recommendations that you make will be implemented in a way that hasn't always happened before? Are you confident that that will happen?
Yes, I'm confident from the conversations I have had with the Secretary of State, from the personal interest that he has shown, the time that he has given to meeting families to appreciate and understand their distress and what has happened to them, and the commitment to the task force, which is in the process of being established now, that change will happen.
I'd like to end our discussion where we began, really, with the experiences of women and parents and families, experiences which, as we said, you found shocking in some cases. There must have been stories that you've heard from the people at the heart of this that have been terribly traumatising for them.
Yes, the experiences I have heard, what women and their families have had to go through. I mean, families talk to me about coming into hospital, being put in rooms, being left in those rooms for hours on end. Women are bleeding out in bathrooms. The poor basic care that they receive, the lack of attention, and that point that Emily made time and time again about not being listened to, that has come up in every single meeting that I have held and come up with just about every single individual that I have spoken to. There is something going on here that we need to get to the bottom of. And I hope that by the time I publish my final report in spring next year, that we will be able to identify some systemic changes that will make a difference.
What would you say to, because there will be parents to be listening to this right now who may be due to give birth tomorrow or next week or next month, and they will be frightened to hear what you're describing. But at the moment, there is no guarantee that the care that they receive will be safe.
I think the important thing that I want everybody out there to remember is that we are focusing, we're very much focusing on the negative, the problems, the challenges, because we have to fix them. There is lots of good care out there. And I want families to feel able, if they are not receiving that care, to raise their voices to say that what is happening to them is unacceptable. But please remember, we have lots of trusts across the country. We have lots of staff who are doing a good job. Our focus here is on the terrible experiences. That does not reflect everything that is happening in our health service. And please, please remember that.
Baroness Amos, the chair of the Maternity and Neonatal Investigation, and Emily Barley, the co-founder of the Maternity Safety Alliance. Thank you for joining us.
And that brings us to 23 minutes past eight. The government's unveiling the branding today of the new Great British Railways. It's another step along the road, stop along the track perhaps, of the full nationalisation of the trains, the tracks, the ticketing, everything that it is bringing in. I've been talking to the Transport Secretary, Heidi Alexander, and we started with when people would start to see real improvements as a result of renationalisation.
Well, I'm actually pleased to say that if you look at something like cancellations, Justin, amongst the directly operated trains at the moment, we have lower cancellation rates than we do on the non-Department for Transport operated services. And so that's good news. And I'm also pleased to say that publicly owned operators such as Greater Anglia, CTC and Southeastern do have some of the lowest cancellation rates across the country, full stop. And I think they're in the three of the top four. So we're not waiting around for Great British Railways to be established in order to make improvements. We do need to rewire the way that the railways work, though. And so that's why, with the legislation that we're taking through Parliament starting this afternoon with its second reading, we'll be setting up Great British Railways to bring together the 17 disparate organisations that are currently involved in running the railways. We're going to get rid of the sort of inefficiency and the waste that has characterised the system for too long. We've got more train operating companies coming into public ownership next year, another four, starting with West Midlands and then GTR, Chiltern and Great Western. We said in our manifesto that we would renationalise the trains. We're getting on with that and we're doing it. I also think people, have seen the fares freeze for next year, the first time in 30 years that train fares have been frozen.
I want to get to that in a second. Before we get to the train fares freeze, you have said that people are going to have to meet, these are the train operating companies, meet rigorous bespoke performance standards. This is punctuality, it's cancellations, etc., etc. What happens if they don't?
So if a particular region is not performing within Great British Railways, and remember that this will be the new publicly owned organisation that brings together the management of the tracks, the infrastructure, the signalling, as well as the train operations, then I would expect, as the Secretary of State, for the leadership of Great British Railways to have a laser-like focus on resolving performance issues in that area. Now, they will have greater tools to be able to do that than they do at the moment, because at the moment, you've got Network Rail that's responsible for one set of things, you've got the train operating companies that are responsible for something else. And so that is why, in establishing Great British Railways, we're able to fix some of things.
Things are going to be easier to fix, people will understand. You're saying that now, and they'll be able to hold you to it in years ahead.
Well, I'll give you a couple of examples, Justin. I mean, last week we had a ridiculous situation where the Office of Rail and Road, which is the regulator of the railways at the moment, decided that there should be a 7 a.m. service that was going to run from Manchester to London, but they wouldn't allow passengers on it. Now, thankfully, the ORR decided to reverse that decision. But in future, it will be Great British Railways that takes decisions about track access and timetables. We've had to wait years for a new East Coast mainline timetable to come in, which is going to come in a phased way next week. This means that, you know, hundreds of millions of pounds of infrastructure improvements on the East Coast Main Line haven't translated into passenger benefits until next week, because everyone was trying to achieve consensus. No one was prepared to take a decision. And actually, it's passengers that ultimately end up paying the price. And so that's why we've got to integrate the management of the tracks and the train much better. And that's what the legislation that we're taking through Parliament this afternoon will be doing.
Let's talk about fares. I want to play you something you said to the Transport Select Committee quite recently. Let's listen to it.
We do need to reduce the amount of rail subsidy on day-to-day spending. We spend over £10 billion a year on infrastructure. That's taxpayers' money that goes into Network Rail to maintain the infrastructure, the signalling, etc. But at the moment, we're also spending about £2 billion of taxpayers' money on subsidising the day-to-day running of the trains. We do need to bring that down.
So you tell the Transport Select Committee you need to reduce the rail subsidy. The Chancellor in the budget has frozen rail fares. In other words, the subsidy effectively will go up. It's incoherent, isn't it, to put it moderately?
No, I don't think it is incoherent to say that over the coming years, we have to reduce the overall level of subsidy that is going into the railways.
So the fares will have to go up in the longer term. It's just that they're not going up now so that you can have the headline.
No, I'm not saying that. You're putting words into my mouth, Justin.
Okay. Tell me what I should be saying.
We take fares decisions on an annual basis. What we saw last year was really strong growth in passenger numbers. We're aware that people are still experiencing cost of living pressures. And so for next year, the Chancellor and I agreed that we would freeze rail fares so that hard-working families can keep more of their hard-earned cash.
But it's the opposite of what you told the Transport Committee you wanted to do, isn't it?
Yeah, but there are other ways in which you can reduce the subsidy. So, for example, the up to £150 million a year that we have been spending in management fees to the private train operating companies, that will no longer be happening because we're bringing the train operating companies into public ownership. You can also appreciate that if you've got 14 different train operating companies, each with their own marketing and advertising teams, each with their own commercial and legal teams, over time, there are ways in which we can save money. I also think we will be incentivising the railways to do the right thing. I know your listeners will be frustrated with things like leaves on the line. And I can tell you why that's such a problem at the moment, because it's Network Rail's responsibility to keep the lines free of leaves. And if trains are late running because of this problem or delayed or cancelled, then actually the train operating companies can then claim some money back from Network Rail. That means that the train operating companies don't have the incentive to fit the sanding equipment, which can reduce the impact of this problem. So actually, we need to get the management better integrated so that we're taking the right decisions at the right time to give both the travelling public and taxpayers better value for money.
Heidi Alexander, Transport Secretary. Thank you very much talking to us.
Thank you.
It's 8:30 now and Carthy's back with the sport.
Hello, good morning. The Liverpool forward Mo Salah has been left out of the squad for tonight's Champions League match at Inter Milan. Salah had said he feels he's been thrown under the bus after being dropped to the bench for Liverpool's last three games. Comments that have surprised the Liverpool manager, Arne Slot, who's denied that the situation with Salah has undermined his authority. Well, the Liverpool and England goalkeeper David James joins us. Morning, David.
Good morning, Carthy.
Quite a few critics have... pundits have criticised what Salah has said over the last 48 hours. Jamie Carragher said it was a disgrace. Chris Sutton said he's made it all about him and not the team. He's been extremely selfish. Do you agree?
Well, first of all, I was disappointed in what Mo said, and I think I have to lean on what Chris Sutton said there, because ultimately it is seeming more about him. And what I wanted to say, the thing is, Carthy, what I wanted to hear was something along the lines of, I'm not performing at the level I was last season. I'm going to try as hard as I can to get back in the team and help Liverpool get back to winning ways. That would have been everyone on Mo's side. I get it, because players are human and they are allowed poor form at any given time. But what he said basically is a dig at both Arne Slot and Liverpool Football Club, I think. And I was disappointed that Mo said that.
Players rarely say things like that, though, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, again, I can empathise, and I think the guys you mentioned there, the former players, can empathise. Everyone gets to a point in their career where they're at a certain age, and
he's 33,
the emotion,
isn't he?
Yeah, and I'm not saying he's over the hill by any stretch, but the point is, yeah, the end of your career is closer than the beginning of your career, and you get into one of those emotional sort of moments. As I say, the form hasn't been right. He has been trying. I don't think we can criticise him for not trying this season. And then it all comes to a head in one interview after a game. So I can empathise with him on that, but I still think there was a better way of saying it.
Yeah, and Slot was asked if Salah would play for Liverpool again. His reply was, I have no clue. Salah is off to the Africa Cup of Nations next week. Is that good timing to put a bit of space between him and Liverpool, or do you think he might have played his last game?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't play again, but then I suppose I wouldn't be surprised if he did. I think you've got to, again, I empathise with Arne Slot here. Mo hasn't been informed, and when he dropped him, I think he was right. When you look at the sort of progression where Mo had been dropped out of a couple of games prior to that, Liverpool haven't lost. They won the first game, drew the next two. And as a manager, he's got to ask the question, who is going to get me or get the club back out of this situation, knowing that one of the players won't be available for, what, a month or so? Let me trust on the players that I have got to turn it round. And, I think with everything that's done, everything that was talked about last season, if there were a team in the world somewhere who could afford to buy Mo Salah, then I wouldn't be surprised if they took the opportunity to do it now.
Yeah, it is interesting, obviously, with them being defending Premier League champions and on the run that you've just mentioned. And the current goalkeeper, Alisson, said, Salah's a legend, he's a great guy, but the situation doesn't make me happy. But they do have a massive challenge now against Inter Milan. And they just have to focus on that tonight, don't they?
Of course, easy. I think, and again, credit to Arne Slot here. I mean, if Mo had travelled, then this conversation would be continuing. I've been a manager and I've had upset players. I've been an upset player. The last thing you want is someone in the corner of the room talking in a bad way. So getting Mo out of the way, Liverpool have to focus on it. Inter Milan, I think, are fourth in the Champions League at the moment on 12 points. A win, which would be a tough task for Liverpool, but capable of doing it. A win would put them on 12 points, and therefore all of a sudden the Champions League positions look a lot better.
Yeah, no, it is a very interesting situation at the moment. David James, thank you very much for chatting to us about that. There's commentary of that game, Inter Milan versus Liverpool, on 5 Live from 8 p.m. Chelsea are away at Atalanta, and Tottenham host Slavia Prague tonight in the Champions League. And the bit of cricket news from this morning: fast bowler Mark Wood has been ruled out of the rest of England's Ashes tour after suffering a recurrence of a knee injury. Wood will be replaced in the squad by Matthew Fisher.
Thank you, Carthy.
There he is.
My name's Pine. I'm the night manager.
On BBC iPlayer.
Richard Roper is selling arms in the heart of Cairo. I want to put you inside his operation.
You got any idea how dangerous that is?
The brand new series of The Night Manager is coming.
You have to commit.
Get ready by watching series one.
Anyone can betray anyone.
You have to make a decision.
Don't you dare threaten me!
The Night Manager.
Oh, I can't wait.
On BBC iPlayer.
And the weather: a wet and windy start across the UK today, as you're doubtless aware. Rain continuing to move north. Cloudy skies then, and showers in the afternoon for the rest of the country. Gales to severe gales in the northwest, though, although later on it will be drier.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Anna Foster. It's 25 to 9. Jane Steele has a summary of the news. The head of a national review into NHS maternity care in England says she's been shocked by what she describes as the repeated experiences of trauma endured by women and families. Baroness Amos told us her final report, due in the spring, would identify systemic changes that would make a difference. But Emily Barley, whose daughter Beatrice died in 2022, said Baroness Amos was minimising the problem, with her initial findings over-focusing on staff experiences over families. Australia's new law banning young teenagers from some of their favourite social media platforms comes into force today. Companies that fail to take reasonable steps to prevent under-16s from opening accounts could face fines of up to £25 million. A police review into the Army's top spy in the IRA, known as Steak Knife, is to publish its final report. The findings are likely to include new information on how he was recruited. A revolutionary gene therapy has successfully treated patients with aggressive and previously incurable blood cancers. The treatment, developed by scientists at Great Ormond Street Hospital and University College London, edits the DNA of white blood cells into what's being called a living drug.
Thank you, Jane. Now, people trying to get hold of their own records from their time spent in care are being let down, so says the Information Commissioner's Office. It wants local authorities and health and social care trusts to take urgent action to speed up that process, which in some cases is taking years. And the information, when it does arrive, can be incomplete or redacted. It just doesn't provide the insight into their background that that person might be hoping for. Well, John Edwards is the Information Commissioner. Good morning.
No.
What have you found? I mean, what should be happening and what is the reality out there?
Well, firstly, what should be happening is that every person has a right of access to information about them. And when we're talking about people who have been in the care system, the local authorities are really the custodians of their biography. So it's a really, you know, awesome responsibility that they have. And we're finding actually that they're not living up to that responsibility. They're letting people down. They're not meeting their basic legal obligations, which are to respond in a timely way. But they're also not responding with the kind of compassion and empathy you would expect when you're dealing with someone who's been in a vulnerable position and who has now summoned the courage to take this step to find out what's happened in their life.
And you are finding, well, you're finding a mixture of good and bad, but we really want to see this improved in quite a big way.
Indeed. We're trying to elevate this issue so that it gets to the chief executives, senior managers and local authorities, because we know the people working at the coal front understand how important this is for people, but they're just not being resourced. And I think the problem in part is that this issue is being dealt with as one of many compliance issues. We know local authority budgets are stretched. We know they've got a lot to do. But this is really important. It affects people's lives. They have this responsibility, and it can either be a really good experience for people and reveal parts of their life that they're trying to understand, or it can in fact re-traumatise them if they're not treated with humanity.
What about the redaction issue? Because in some cases records simply aren't there, but in others it's very clear that something is
missing? Is there a lack of understanding from people providing that information, what they should be handing over?
It's difficult to generalise. I think most of the people in charge of doing these redactions do so in good faith. They're trying to protect the privacy of others. What I would like to see is a little more curiosity and humanity, so that, for example, if they're deleting records of siblings, maybe they have the conversation with the care experienced person and say, look, you know, is your brother or sister aware of this? Would they like to be part of this? Do you have their permission? So there are ways around this that can make it seem less bureaucratic. There's nothing worse for someone than to go through that process of seeking access and then to receive a folder that just has a whole lot of blacked out pages. It just raises more questions for them.
The Local Government Association have said in response that many councils don't have the resource to do this as a result of historic funding pressures, among other things. But as you said, this is a legal requirement. It's not a choice.
Exactly. They don't get to choose. They have to. And, you know, we've seen one case where a person waited 16 years to get access to that information, which is their legal right. And that is simply not acceptable.
John Edwards, the Information Commissioner, thank you for joining us. Well, Ashley John-Baptiste is also with us this morning, BBC presenter and author who's written about his own childhood in the care system. Morning.
Hiya, good morning.
What was your experience when you tried to get hold of your own records?
Well, I was in my mid-20s when I requested my care files. And by way of context, I was looked after between the ages of 2 and 18. So that's a long time, four different foster families and also a care home. So when I requested my files, there was so much I didn't know about my childhood. For example, I remember being in a home at 7 and having to leave that home. I thought that home would be my forever family. I had a great connection with the foster mum. And when I left as a child, I was given no information about why I had to leave that home. And so requesting my files, it was critical. I was relying on them to know who I was, where I came from, why decisions were made. And much of what John says chimes with my experience. It was really frustrating. I had to wait a matter of months. I was told about redactions with regard to third-party privacy. The process was bureaucratic and also humiliating. I felt like I was being an inconvenience, I suppose, to the local authority. And I suppose the most bewildering aspect to the whole process in reading my files was that the files didn't tell me that I had biological siblings. And my files didn't tell me that I was considered for adoption. These were facts that I would go on to find out, actually, when pursuing a bit of BBC journalism. So really critical, life-changing information was not revealed to me in these files that I really did rely on. And I suppose the process left me hurt, frustrated, and left me with more questions than answers.
Yeah, it must be a difficult way to find out as well, because you haven't got somebody who's there, who's thinking about the kindest or most sensitive way to pass that information across to you. You just get papers which might have the answers, might not. Things are very stark and you've just got to start flicking through it. And that, I imagine, is really hard as well.
Absolutely. I had to make a formal request via email, and the delays, the process of understanding the redactions, as I've touched on, was frustrating. And also, there was no therapeutic support. You know, I was in my 20s, still grappling with the realities of what it was to be a care leaver, trying to live independently as an adult. And here I am, trying to access really triggering content.
For people, because there will be people listening to this who are in that position and who are thinking, well, is it something I should do? Is it something I should hold off from? What would you say to them?
I would say there are some incredible charities like Quorum, like the Care Leavers Association, who seek to support care experienced people. It's really worth sort of finding an organisation who can perhaps provide some of that therapeutic support. Being aware of your rights, you know, we've touched on the fact that local authorities have a duty to do this. I think, you know, making this request, knowing that actually you have a right to your own information, is really important. So knowing your rights and finding organisations who can really walk with you in that process of something that can be really triggering, yeah, and stressful, actually.
And on the other side of that, there will also be people listening who work at local authorities or at trusts or the people who hold this information. And I suppose to them, you would say, do this with a bit of care.
Yeah, well, I think this is why what's coming from the Information Commissioner's Office is really useful. You know, this call for an urgent improvement, actually, in how care records are built and how they're accessed from local authorities across the UK. I think it's a really important call. And I think that, you know, when local authorities, when social care professionals, teachers, you know, compile these records, it's really important that the young person is at the centre of the documentation and the compiling of these records.
Ashley John-Baptiste, BBC presenter and author, thank you.
It has just come up to 8:45. 30 years ago, the 8th of December 1995, the London headmaster Philip Lawrence was stabbed to death at the gates of his school as he tried to protect a pupil. His murder shocked the nation. It led to politicians on all sides calling for urgent action on knife crime. The BBC radio presenter Edward Adu was a pupil at the time, a pupil at that school, and he credits Mr. Lawrence for igniting his passion for radio, inspiring a generation of pupils as well to achieve great things. He's presented documentaries about his former teacher, wants to keep his memory alive. 5 years ago, Edward made a programme looking back at his legacy, and one of the guests in that documentary was Lord Howard, who was Home Secretary at the time that Philip Lawrence was killed.
It was obviously a very, very shocking event. A headmaster stabbed to death when he was trying to break up a fight at the gates of his school. It was absolutely horrific that anything like that could happen in the middle of our capital city. None of us contemplated that that was something that could happen.
The government is setting up a working party to look into violence in schools after the murder of the London headteacher Philip Lawrence. The move was welcomed by unions representing teachers in England and Wales. They'd been to see the Education Secretary to demand better security.
We passed a law, it was actually a private member's bill, and that imposed tougher sentences for the possession of knives. That was its main provision, and that had quite a significant impact.
Let's talk to Edward Adu, the BBC radio presenter, who, as I was saying, was a pupil at Mr. Lawrence's school at the time of his death. Morning to you, Edward.
Morning, Justin. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you for coming on. Look, it's interesting, isn't it, hearing all those years ago, this awful event, politicians coming together, clamped down on knife crime, passed new legislation, etc. I think anecdotally, at least, the feeling is that in a sense, things have only got worse.
Nothing's changed. And I was talking to Frances Lawrence, the widow of Mr. Lawrence, and I was talking about the Philip Lawrence Awards, which was set up in memory and to give back to youngsters. And Frances came up with a good point. It's about love. It's about care. It's about passion. And I think, sadly, a lot of young people get often dismissed and sort of put in a box. And that's, Mr. Lawrence didn't do that. And I think what made St. George's a unique school, he gave back to the pupils and to the community. And he gave me an opportunity. I mean, when I knocked on his door one morning after watching an episode of Neighbours and asked if I could set up a school radio station, I thought he would just tell me off and say, look, stop wasting my time. But he said, how do you envisage running the radio station? And within days, we set it up from his office, from the Assembly Hall. He gave me an opportunity. He gave others an opportunity. I think if community leaders and teachers can give young people a chance, give them time and understand what's going on in their world, that might be that might solve the issues that we're having on the
street. It's interesting that, isn't it? Presumably wouldn't solve them completely, but what you're saying is that just legislation about knife crime is not the way. It's and I suppose everyone understands this, but it's not the solution eventually lies.
Justin, we have to be frank about this and say, look, you can put whatever legislation you can on the table to try and resolve a problem, but that will not resolve any issue. The problem is, it's the heart of what's going on. It's to find out why the perpetrators decided to do what they did in the first place and to tap into their lifestyles related to, you know, upbringing, you know, what's going on at home. Many cases, you'll find that the people involved, they don't have a loving environment. they're at home. Their parents often doing three or four jobs. Their parents are not there. Their parents are not there to put food on the table. So therefore, there is no love and admiration. I think if we can get to the crux of that, then that will solve the problem. I'm no magician or specialist. I'm just a broadcaster who speaks to many people and happen to have a great headmaster who was able to understand what was going on, in particular in the community around St. George's.
Yeah. But and a man whose life we need to remember, because it was 30 years ago, and it's important to remember Mr. Lawrence as well, and the impact that he had on you, but also on many other pupils as well. Edward Adu, thank you.
Later this morning on Woman's Hour, Krupa Pathy and her guests will discuss the importance of strength training and exercise for people on weight loss drugs, as well as looking at why bows are back in fashion. Not sure they ever went away here, did they? That's all on Woman's Hour this morning at 10.
10 to 9 is the time. Now, what rights do women have to object to sharing spaces, lavatories, changing rooms, etc. with biological males who identify as women? After the Supreme Court ruled that a woman is a biological female, it seemed pretty clear. Now, though, an employment tribunal seems to have muddied the waters. The Scottish nurse, Sandy Peggy, was found to have been harassed by the NHS when she complained about having to share a changing room with a trans woman doctor. So she won that part of the case, but she did lose other parts. And crucially, the tribunal appears to believe that trans women, biological males, do not present any more of a threat to women than other females. Let us talk to Dr. Michael Foran, who is an associate professor of law at the University of Oxford and has built a huge reputation as someone who knows about the things and the intricacies of the law in these cases. Dr. Foran, good morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
Where does it leave the Supreme Court judgment? Is it a challenge to it, do you think?
Well, I think it certainly places us in a more complicated position than I think we might previously had thought that we were in, not least because the employment tribunal here, first and foremost, I should say that the employment tribunal is not law at the moment, in the sense that it makes findings that are binding on the parties before it, but it's not binding in any other employment tribunals unless or until there's an appeal. So until we get an appeal, a case that goes to the Court of Appeal, the Supreme Court judgment is the definitive legal...
Well, that's very interesting and very important. So for employers and indeed for women around the country concerned about this, nothing has changed from the Supreme Court's determination.
That's right. I mean, certainly what we've seen from this judgment yesterday is that there's a more complicated picture emerging from what at least this judge in this employment tribunal has concluded. And I think one of the difficulties that's arising here is that this judgment seems to draw a distinction between how single-sex services operate when they're provided for the public and how they're provided in the employment context, and seems to introduce an awful lot of considerations that employers would have to take into account that, in my view, the Supreme Court had made an active effort to avoid us having to consider.
Right,
so the Supreme Court decision says that in order for single-sex services to operate clearly, you have to be able to have rules that are based on biological sex. But this judgment seems to indicate that whether or not these rules operate appropriately will depend on how the trans person looks, how they present, what surgery they've had, whether they have a genuine commitment to their identity. These are kinds of considerations that will make it very difficult, I think, for employers, or if this is extended to service providers,
and
to make this kind of decision.
Support of that view, what they say is, having read all the documents, there's far from sufficient reliable evidence to establish as a fact that a trans woman who is legally and biologically male is a greater risk to any person assigned female at birth within a changing room environment at a workplace than another woman assigned female at birth. So inside the workplace, they're saying effectively, biological males are not a danger to biological females.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that there's two points I'd make about that. The first is that, you know, if you read what the court is saying, it's effectively saying that we don't have the evidence before us to make this kind of conclusion.
To which a lot of women would say, well, hang on a second, there is evidence in thousands and thousands of years of human experience that males can present a danger to females. Not all males, obviously, but males in aggregate do.
Yes, I mean, I think that, that's a very fair observation. One of the points that I might make is that the tribunal was very clear in this judgment that it was only going to draw evidence from what had been put before it in specific evidence from the parties or from what was within judicial knowledge. And it went so far as to say there was a report that was put before it by one of the parties about some of these risks, but it said the evidence that was contained in that report was not before the tribunal. Some of it might have been contained within hyperlinks, but the tribunal did not feel empowered to click on those hyperlinks to look at what those evidence or the statistics that were produced by the Ministry of Justice would apply. So I think there was a very narrow approach to what kind of evidence the court was going to rely on.
Final thought, do you think there will be an appeal? Do you think there needs to be, actually, to sort out what the law currently is?
Well, I mean, unless there's an appeal, this decision has no binding or wider legal effect. It's just confined to the facts before it. So I'm pretty sure that there will be an appeal. It seems like Sandy Peggy's lawyers have indicated that they're considering making an appeal. And from my look at this judgment, there's quite a lot to think about that we might warrant having further consideration by a more superior court on this.
Dr. Michael Foran, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Oxford, thank you.
It's 9:05. Here's a little treat for you to close the programme today. Dame Judi Dench treating the audience of the Graham Norton Show to Shakespeare's Sonnet 29.
When in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state, and trouble death heaven with my bootless cries, and look upon myself and curse my fate, wishing me like to one more rich in hope, featured like him with friends possessed, desiring this man's art and that man's scope, with what I most enjoy contented least, yet in these thoughts myself almost despising. Happily I think on thee, and then my state, like to the lark at break of day arising from sullen earth, sings hymns at heaven's gate. For thy sweet love remembered such wealth brings, that then I scorn to change my state with kings.
That. Wow.
Well, despite being able to recite endless Shakespearean works like that, Dame Judy's told the Radio Times that actually her short-term recall is now quite poor. She says she can't remember what she's doing tomorrow, which raises interesting questions about how our memories work and how they change as we get older. Professor Tara Spires-Jones is from the UK Dementia Research Institute at the University of Edinburgh, past president of the British Neuroscience Association. Good morning.
Good morning.
In general, whether or not we have one of these conditions, our brains do change the way that they store memories as we get older, don't they?
Yes, absolutely. During aging, most of us experience decreases in some kinds of our cognition, and these include some aspects of memory, speed of processing information, like our reaction times, and executive functions like decision-making and planning and reasoning. But you may have be familiar with Oscar Wilde's quote, with age comes wisdom, but sometimes age comes alone. Many of us have actually increases in some areas of cognition, like crystallized intelligence, things like verbal ability, vocabulary, and general knowledge actually improve.
That's true, actually, isn't it? That there are certain things, you know, we have more knowledge, it comes out. But it's also curious how our brains decide what to remember, you know, be it something useless like song lyrics, for example, from your teenage years, when there would be a lot more useful bits of information that your brain knows it would benefit from, but doesn't hold on to.
Yeah, and we don't really fully understand why that is. The brain is amazing and all of us are very different, but there are some reasons why some events are very memorable. And I think it comes back to sort of survival. So if you were a person coming out from behind a rock and a tiger jumped out from behind that rock, you would remember that particular rock, right? Because it's very important to your survival. And in the brain, that's mediated by things like the neurotransmitter dopamine that's sort of secreted when we're excited or when there's something really important and novel. And that helps the memory be stronger.
And I think as well, for those of us who have older relatives, it's fascinating in many ways that if you do have something like dementia or Alzheimer's, often your short-term recall will be poor, but those people will be able to remember in quite some detail what they did years and years ago, their childhood, for example.
Absolutely. And that's fascinating. And that is because the part of the brain that makes new memories is different from the part that stores consolidated long-term memories. So the part that makes new memories, or one of the most important parts, is called the hippocampus. It's a beautiful seahorse-shaped structure kind of behind your ears. And during aging, and even more so during dementias caused by Alzheimer's disease, that part of the brain shrinks and really loses neurons, the brain cells and the connections. So when that happens, even though you can still remember things that are already encoded, you can't make the new memories as well. And so that's why you can remember things from long ago, but not yesterday or 5 minutes ago as well.
Yeah, it is absolutely fascinating. Thank you for telling us more about it. Professor Tara Spires-Jones.